the advertisement for Mountain Dew.
You got that one too.
You know, we probably should have banned it or something. You know.
You could have got some kind of compensation.
It just kind of fuels the fire, though, doesn't it? The adrenaline going.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that anymore.
No, probably not.
It's 6 o'clock preparing response to the ocean moon and the trial I got this week. So I might need it.
That's true.
Nudge me.
Okay, well. Interning back.
You've got one of those. An agenda.
I heard that one.
They were. Yeah, I don't know if they were handed out. I put them right behind you. I don't know what they were just sitting here.
Oh, that's right. We were looking for them in our packets.
Okay.
Hey, Chris, you might want to give them to those guys just to see if they want to hand them out. That's what they wanted to do.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Ready.
I got my Federalist Papers.
Give this to me.
I've got
Jude of the Lake School.
Or case, if I can mix metaphors.
I think it is.
Really?
I think so.
Well, that would be appropriate.
Is St. Jude the patron saint of love?
Good afternoon. We will call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. We're going to have a series of hearings, as I think everyone knows, on issues relating to reducing gun violence and addressing issues of guns and violence. And I'm going to, because of the intense public interest, I'm going to lay out a couple of ground rules for everyone so that we have an orderly proceeding today, and so everyone knows what to expect. We will be taking up a number of bills over the course of the next 2 days. We will not be taking any formal action on any of these bills, except in some cases to provide for author's amendments, which are typically undebated procedural moves to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes for the committee to consider it. So the bills will help provide us with some guidance and proposals before the legislature, before this committee, as a framework for our discussions and our presentations. But we will be not taking any official action. We will lay over each of the bills for consideration for inclusion in an omnibus bill to be put together at a later time, and then when that happens, we will come back and again have a public hearing on whatever form that omnibus bill proposal takes. For the proceedings here, there will be 20 minutes given to the opponents of a bill and 20 minutes to the proponents of the bill. We will be marking that time fairly and strictly, because we have so many people that want to participate, and we want to make sure that we are scrupulously fair to each side of the discussion. After those presentations, there will be 10 minutes to hear from additional testifiers in the audience, and there will also be 20 minutes for senators to ask questions of those who have testified or to have some discussion. We will only take testimony on the bills in front of the committee. That means, as has been already noted in the last several days, there will be no testimony taken or allowed on proposals relating to assault rifle bans or magazine clip restrictions, as we are not going to be hearing bills with those proposals. For purposes of decorum, it is protocol in the hearing, and we will enforce it, that no clapping or other disruptive behavior will be allowed. And please do not leave the room without getting a ticket from the sergeant at the door if you wish to return to the room. All right. So having sort of set the table for the hearing, our first presentation will be from NAMI. We ask Sue Abderholden, and I have on my testifier list Benjamin Ashley Wertman and Tricia Stark to come to the table, please. Make sure you identify yourselves for the recording and sign in at the sign-in sheet that is also on the table. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Abderholden, and you may go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sue Abderholden. I'm executive director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI understands the desire to respond in wake of the tragedies such as Sandy Hook shooting. We, too, want to make sure that our children and communities are safe and that our own loved ones are protected from taking their own lives. The solutions, however, are not easy. Targeting people who live with a mental illness is unlikely to have a significant impact on reducing gun violence because for the vast majority of people living with mental illnesses, violence is not an issue. We need to unlink violence and mental illnesses, especially in light of how common they are. One in four adults live with a mental illness in a given year, and about 4% experience serious mental illnesses, which can include conditions such as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depression, and beyond. While having an untreated serious mental illness can, in some cases, raise the risk of violence, especially for people who are using substances, only 5% of violent acts are committed by people with mental illnesses, according to the Institute of Medicine. It is telling that in the corrections world, mental illnesses are not considered when measuring someone's risk of recidivism, violent or not. In Minnesota, correction agencies rely on an evidence-based risk assessment tool called the Level of Service Case Management Inventory to assess a person's risk of offending. This tool does not include whether someone lives with a mental illness because the research simply doesn't show enough of a connection between having a mental illness and committing crimes, again, violent or not. Thus, it's not surprising that we don't see research demonstrating that simply expanding gun restrictions for people with serious mental illnesses prevents gun violence. Another reason not to focus on people with mental illnesses in debates like this one is that it risks further stigmatizing people with mental illnesses, discouraging them from seeking professional help. Stigma has real consequences. Largely due to stigma, people wait an average of 10 years before seeking mental health treatment. And a survey published this month in the New England Journal of Medicine found that 46% of respondents said they believe those with serious mental illnesses are more dangerous than others, 71% said they wouldn't want to work closely with a person who had a mental illness, and 67% said they wouldn't want a neighbor with a mental illness. The consequences of delayed mental health care are great. There are poor outcomes, such as dropping out of school, being unemployed, or homeless. Suicide is a greater concern, and in Minnesota, we lost 599 people to suicide versus 111 for homicide. So how do we prevent suicides and mass shootings? Minnesota statutes already prevent people who have been committed due to being in danger of hurting themselves or others or being unable to care for themselves from accessing guns. Adding more disqualifiers based on having a mental illness casts an extremely wide net, deters people from accessing treatment voluntarily, and doesn't truly address public safety. We are working with authors to try to identify people who may be at risk for violence without focusing on people simply having a mental illness. We're confident that we'll be able to come up with an agreement. We support Senator Latz's bill to allow people to voluntarily add themselves to a registry of people ineligible for guns. Many people we talk to would add themselves to such a registry, assuming it was not available to public audiences like landlords and employers. Beyond that, the best thing that we can do to address mental illnesses, to the extent they play a role at all, is to ensure real access to mental health treatment. Only 39% of people who live with a mental illness receive treatment in a given year. Accessing care can be extremely difficult due to the lack of coverage, funding and workforce shortages, and the discrimination that exists under private health plans, Medicaid, and Medicare, where mental health treatment is not covered the same way as other illnesses. Even if your insurance covers psychiatry, the wait for an appointment is 3 months minimum. And community-based services are scarce enough that too often people are released from psychiatric hospitalization, even while under commitment, to shelters and homelessness. We also need to improve early identification of and intervention for mental illnesses, especially knowing that half of all adults who live with a serious mental illness began experiencing symptoms before the age of 14. This can be done effectively through schooling to mental health services. In particular, Minnesota needs more programs for people having their first episode of psychosis. Psychosis can mean hallucinations, delusions, or both. First episode of psychosis programs provide individual and family education, intensive therapy, support groups, and help the person engage in education or employment. These are the individuals most at risk if they cannot access intensive treatment. The psychiatrist who devised the first episode, the original first episode program, says, "The kids who go on gun rampages tend to be pre-psychotic. Most people with mental illnesses are not dangerous, but these may be. They still have enough functioning to methodically plot out their attacks. They have lost their capacity for judgment, but not yet for planning." In addition to first episode of psychosis programs, we need to beef up our community-based services in both the children and adult systems. These include care coordination, supportive housing, supported employment, and more. As you listen to testimony and work to prevent gun violence, we ask that you remember that most people with mental illnesses are not violent. And this, for the small percentage that are, ensuring access to community services may be the answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. And I know you were made aware of this ahead of time, but I didn't announce it publicly, but your group has 10 minutes to make your presentation. And so we've got another 5 minutes to go. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a licensed psychologist and legislative chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association. When events occur, such as those in Newtown, Connecticut, or Aurora, Colorado, we all look to find answers to prevent future tragedies. In choosing methods of prevention, it's important that they be well-balanced, well-founded on the basis of the best evidence and research, in order to balance protection of the public and the rights of citizens. And we're very appreciative of the authors of the bills that they've been willing to work with us on these issues. The factors that converge related to violence are complex and interrelated, but studies repeatedly find that mental illness does not cause violence. What major prospective studies demonstrate is that violence can be best predicted when a number of factors are considered. These factors include dispositional, historical, clinical, and contextual factors. Factors related to severe violence include younger age, male sex, having less than a high school diploma, a history of past violence, juvenile detention, perception of hidden threats from others, and being divorced or separated in the last year. In terms of the strength of predictors, from the most influenced to the least, factors are younger age, a history of past violence, being male, a history of juvenile detention, recent divorce or separation, history of physical abuse as a child, parental criminal history, unemployed the last year, having a major mental illness and substance abuse, but not one, either one on its own, and having been victimized in the last year. It's necessary to look beyond the mental health diagnosis and look at an individual's prior history and what is transpiring now in their lives. A nuanced approach based upon the best information is likely to protect the public while maintaining the privacy and rights of individuals. It's reasonable to consider someone at risk who has a severe mental illness and substance abuse or dependence and a past history of violence. Such an additive approach can appropriately address risk. Using a standardized assessment of risk, such as the classification of violence risk, could increase accuracy while ensuring that individuals with mental illness are not inappropriately targeted, leading to increased stigma. Such an approach might also avoid the very real unintended consequences of dissuading individuals with mental health concerns or substance abuse from pursuing life-saving and enhancing treatment for fear of the loss of rights. Research does provide information about the kinds of interventions that can reduce the likelihood of violence, including providing support and mental health services for children, and more dynamic or changing factors can be addressed through the provision of integrated dual disorder treatments, vocational services, supported employment, increasing the availability of mental health services for families in crisis, and enhancing services for victims of crime. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I'm Policy and Outreach Associate for Mental Health Association Minnesota, and I will try to be very brief here. MHAM has no stance on guns generally, but we would be opposed to any restriction that unfairly singles out people with mental illness without substantial justification. At MHAM, our advocates talk with people daily about their struggles to find help for mental illness. They might end up getting help from a primary care doctor, it might be county services, it might be the emergency room, it might be 911. But how they enter the door to the system does not predict their long-term outcomes or how serious their mental illness will be or if they will be violent in any way, shape, or form. I want to leave you with two things today. The first is that hospitalization and emergency holds are very temporary measures. Police and doctors are given broad authority and discretion to take care of mental health care crises and address them as best they can. That authority is appropriate because the measures are purely temporary. Sometimes 911 is the only place that people know how to call, and so people should not fear that that call for help is going to somehow label them in a long-term way as potentially violent. About 10 years ago, I needed both 911 and hospitalization to help keep me safe. Personally, I have very little interest in owning a firearm, but I would find it very troubling if my state began to consider me at risk for violence based on that medical history alone. The second thing that I want to leave you with is that emergency care is best achieved through cooperation. Many individuals agree to care once they are contacted by law enforcement. People on 72-hour holds are required to be given the opportunity to ask for a change to voluntary status instead of an involuntary hold. If emergency holds are stigmatized, I'm afraid that people may be less willing to trust or cooperate. I believe that we cannot afford to create more fear of hospitalization or fear of contact with law enforcement. We know that 911 still carries too much burden in the mental health system, but that's our current reality. We should not penalize people who come through that door, because the heart of our system is recovery, and we hope to improve and build on that foundation. I do want to close by thanking the authors for their willingness to continue the conversation with us and other advocates in order to find improved language that will not unfairly stigmatize people with mental illness. If that language is adopted, we will happily return to our neutrality on gun issues. Thank you.
Thank you. And as long as you're here, I don't know if you'll be sticking around, but I'm going to see if there are any questions from members of the committee at this time for any of the testifiers at the table. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Abderholden or Mr. Ashley Wertman, I believe that there's a federal law that says that if a person has been deemed by a court to be dangerous from a civil perspective, that individual could be prohibited from buying weapons. Do you have any difficulty with that definition and meaning if the state decided to go in that direction that would mirror the federal law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, no, because you've had a due process hearing, so you've had a court say, no, you're a danger to yourself or others, or you can't take care of yourself, and then you're already limited from accessing a gun, and we would be fine with that.
Senator Limmer and Chair, just to add real briefly, you've also had advice of counsel. They've told you what's at stake for you, and there's a whole raft of things. You know, your immediate freedom is at stake, and they can talk about the long-term consequences as well. So, I would not have issue with language that restricted gun ownership of people under commitment orders.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony. The next presentation will be from Howard Vogel, Professor Emeritus of Constitutional Law, from Hamline University. And as Mr. Vogel's coming to the table, for those who were interested in Senate File 69, which is on the agenda for yet this afternoon, Senator Ingebrigtsen moved on the Senate floor in the last hour to withdraw his bill from the committee and have it returned to the author. So this committee no longer has jurisdiction over Senate File 69, and we will not be hearing any testimony for or against that particular proposal. Professor Vogel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Glatz.
And you have 10 minutes, so you know. And by the way, for those keeping track, after that we will begin addressing some individual bills, and the first one will be Senate File 235. Professor Vogel.
Thank you very much, Senator Glatz. I'm here as a resident of St. Paul, Minnesota, currently residing in Senate District 66. I've lived my entire life in the state of Minnesota, having been born and raised in rural Minnesota, and spent much of my adult life here in the Twin Cities. In January of last year, I retired from the full-time tenured faculty at Hamline University School of Law, where I taught the foundational course in constitutional law to over 3,600 students during a period of 37 years. In that course, one of the most important things that students learn is that no clause of the Constitution, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Third, Fourth, Fifth, whatever it might be, no clause of that Constitution can be read by itself outside the context of the entire text of the Constitution and the structure of governmental power and individual rights that has been established under our Constitution. That principle is what informs what I have to say today. My testimony is in support of all of these proposals that are trying to deal with the problem of gun violence, Senate File 235 in particular, the tightening of the criminal code there, and Senate File 458 in particular with its approach to background tests, background checks. The core message of my testimony here today, and I hope that you'll have questions for me, is this. The Minnesota State Legislature has constitutional power to enact reasonable, uniform regulations of general application. Reasonable, uniform regulations of general application concerning the commercial sale, the possession of and use of firearms as specified in these bills. This is supported by the Supreme Court's most recent cases in this District of Columbia versus Heller and McDonald versus City of Chicago. The Heller case applied it to federal action. The McDonald case expanded these principles to state action. I'm just going to read a couple of quotes and then comment on them. In the Heller opinion, Justice Scalia, writing for the court, held the following, quote, "The Second Amendment guarantees the individual right to possess and carry weapons in case of confrontation. That is not an issue here in this committee hearing. That right is secure by that case. The core meaning of that right," Justice Scalia went on, "is self-defense. That's not an issue in this hearing either. In his words, the inherent self-defense, right to self-defense, has been central to the Second Amendment right." He goes on to write that this need is particularly acute in the context of the family and the home. But in reaching his decision, Justice Scalia took pains to note that the right to keep and bear arms, like all other rights protected by the Bill of Rights and other provisions of the Constitution, are not unlimited. As he says, of course, the right to keep and bear arms was not unlimited, just as the First Amendment's right of free speech was not. Thus, he goes on, "We do not read the Second Amendment to protect the rights of citizens to carry arms for any," and he italicized the word "any," "sort of confrontation, just as we do not read the First Amendment to protect the right of citizens to speak for any," underline that purpose. You may have heard sometime in your life the statement that's often made that you don't have the right to shout fire in a crowded, darkened theater. That purpose is excluded under the First Amendment. In holding that the Second Amendment protects the right of individuals to keep and bear arms, Justice Scalia engaged in an extensive discussion of the text and the tradition which surrounds it. And then he made a very, very important statement on page 628. He said, "Like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. From Blackstone through the 19th century," Blackstone was a famous English jurist, "through the 19th century cases, commentators and courts routinely explained that the right was not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever for whatever purpose. Background checks would be the one mechanism to determine whether or not certain weapons or certain people would be permitted to carry them." He goes on to say, quote, "Nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on the long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons, the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools, government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms." I'll repeat that last phrase. These are Justice Scalia's words. "Nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. To the extent that a universal background check places a condition or qualification on the commercial sale of arms, it fits within the scope of this opinion." Later, he goes on to note that our tradition even includes the power of the legislature to enact prohibiting the carrying of dangerous and unusual weapons. So Thompson machine guns have been excluded for decades in the United States. Now, let me make a couple comments on these. In sum, what Scalia is saying is that the court is upholding both the right of the individuals to keep and bear arms for self-defense in the home and this is what I want you to understand most clearly, the power of government, including state government, to enact reasonable, uniform regulations of general application for commercial sales, what types of weapons may be sold, possessed, and used by whom, in what places, and under what circumstances. In so doing, the court has provided legislatures like this one on what constitutes reasonable, uniform rules of general application for the prevention of gun violence. Prevention of such violence is a core traditional purpose of government, and it's especially traditional in the states. Within our constitutional structure, power is divided between the federal and the state governments, and individual rights place limits on what both of these governments may do. Under our constitutional structure, there are some things that are traditionally within state legislative power. Thus, now referring to more than the Second Amendment, the 10th Amendment explicitly recognizes the power of the state to use its reserved power, part of which is sometimes called, quote, the police power, to enact legislation for the purpose of protecting what the Supreme Court has referred to time and time again as the, quote, health, safety, and welfare, close quote, of the people of the state, which is what I take these bills to be doing. This is exactly what the bill to establish universal background checks on all commercial sales you are now considering is designed to do. In light of the state's power to provide, then, for the health, safety, and welfare of the people, therefore, the question before you today is not a legal question of whether you have the power to consider and enact this bill, but whether you have the political will to make this choice, which you can make, of public policy in order to begin the urgent task of stopping the flow of blood that has come from the indiscriminate use of firearms, a flow of blood that spares no one, not even our children, and which has, over the last 45 years, taken the lives of more Americans than the sum total of all of our wars. Scalia closes his opinion with these words. "We are aware of the problem of handgun violence in this country. The Constitution leaves the District of Columbia a variety of tools for combating that problem, including some measures regulating handguns. The measures that you are considering today, in my view, fit within that." And I'll close with these words of my own. The story of this country, the story of America, is the story of a long love affair with liberty that is now in its third century. It is equally clear that the story of America embraces the core idea that liberty is not license. Responsibilities come with freedom. Responsibilities come with rights. Responsibilities come with the power that is given to you under the state constitution and recognized under the 10th Amendment of the federal constitution. Liberty is not license. Government has the power that comes from we the people so that we can all enjoy the many forms of liberty we hold dear in peace and the safety of the communities in which we live and share our lives. Thus, the Constitution contemplates and the Supreme Court has affirmed that state governments like ours have the power to enact reasonable, uniform regulations of general application for commercial sales. I'd be happy to take questions, and I brought a copy of this plus some extended remarks that if you'll identify your administrative aide, I'd be happy to pass it on to that person.
Thank you, Professor, Thank you. And we'll have someone approach you to get a copy of that. We'll make it a part of the public record. Are there any questions for Professor Vogel? Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Professor, just a couple of questions. As I understand the Scalia majority opinion, I had a chance to reread it a few days ago. Now, the issue at hand was that the District of Columbia prohibited the possession of any handguns anywhere in the district. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so the central issue was whether or not there was a right to own a firearm, particularly in the home. Am I misstating that?
Correct. There was an absolute prohibition of it, and that's – I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen. That's where the district went too far, is absolutely prohibiting the handguns.
And in that instance, the respondent, Mr. Heller, had a gun in his home for protection.
Correct.
Okay. But – and obviously Justice Scalia – you cited some of the language of Justice Scalia where he talks about the state power to – in effect, regulate issues ancillary to the usage of a gun in the home. Is it a fair inference from his opinion that you talked about background checks, for instance? Now, Mr. Chairman, I realize any legislation dealing with clips or anything of that sort is not an issue for this hearing. Can I inquire of Professor Vogel, though?
Senator Cohen, I'd rather not go
okay,
into
fine.
Those issues,
okay.
please. Thank you.
Is there, in terms of the legislation that we have in front of us, you don't think, have you reviewed the legislation?
Yes, I have.
So is there anything in the proposed legislation that we're hearing today or tomorrow that would be curtailed by the Scalia majority opinion in terms of, if you could think of the most extreme kind of background check registration or whatever, does Scalia go that far?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, well, that's a hypothetical situation that I'd be reluctant to, you know, pass judgment on because I'd want to see it. I'd when you get to the omnibus stage, I think it'll be important to look at that. What's clear is that this legislature has room for choice, and it can include a lot of things, and today we're talking about background checks. What I would say is that I think the background checks would have to be meaningful. The purpose of a background check is to secure data, reliable data, that appropriate authorities can rely upon in making judgments about issuing permits. It has to be reliable data. It has to be meaningful. If it doesn't do that, then I think we're in trouble. And we can only make a judgment on that when we look at it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I could make a couple of other inquiries.
Senator Cohen.
Now, obviously, the McDonald case, as you pointed out, the Heller case dealt with the District of Columbia, which is under federal jurisdiction. The McDonald case dealt with, I think, was it the state of Illinois? And in that case, court said that the state of Illinois could do what they wanted. Conversely, and again, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if this lends itself to the hearing, but conversely, you know, we have legislation moving forward. I don't know what's going on in the Congress, but obviously legislation that's been introduced. If there are different federal laws that come into play, are we as a state bound then to follow those federal dictates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I think that's a very important question. I think it's a question that is raised by Senator Limmer's bill. He's one of the authors of Senate File 400, and I would suggest we discuss that tomorrow when that bill is being heard. If I can just do a 10-second thing on basic principles of constitutional law, the reason that there are two cases, Heller and McDonald, is that the Bill of Rights has always been held until the 20th century to be a limitation on federal power. It was only in the 20th century that the protections in the Bill of Rights started to be, through a process called incorporation, to be applied to the states. For many, many years, the only thing that was limited by the Bill of Rights was the federal government. And so the McDonald case, differently than what you said, the McDonald case takes the principles in Heller without disturbing them, which is a little different than what you said, and applies them to the states like states of Minnesota. In that case, it involved the city of Chicago through a process that brings the provisions of the Bill of Rights to the states for a limitation through the 14th Amendment. So before the 14th Amendment was passed, there were no limits on the states in terms of what the Bill of Rights said. The famous case in 1833, Barron versus Baltimore by Chief Justice Marshall. So we don't have to talk about those two cases. What's clear is the principles of Heller limit this state. And also the 10th Amendment provides power for this state, which comes through our state constitution, reserve power, never given to the federal government, to do certain things that provide for health, safety, and welfare. And Scalia recognizes that when he says at the end, the district has the room to make choices. Now, if you make a choice on anything that someone thinks violates the federal constitution, they can sue. But until that happens, we're not talking about a constitutional issue or any other kind of legal issue. And the misleading selection for discussion of gun control that only focuses on the second half of the Second Amendment drops the entire Constitution out of the picture. We are a country that has powers and rights, and there's a tension and a balance that's constantly being adjusted over time. It changes from decade to decade. It's a dynamic process, and that's what you're involved in.
One last question,
Mr.
Chairman, thank you, that which maybe gets a little bit obscure, but what I've had a very tough time getting my arms around relative to the Second Amendment discussions is the issue of militia versus standing army, because the only thing I can find in the historic references, I know at the convention, I don't think there was, I feel like just a couple of the delegates even raised the question, but there was no substantive discussion. But the issue of the fear of a standing army comes through in a lot of the subsequent legislative debates in terms of ratification. And so I have a tough time figuring out, because I haven't found a lot of historic references to how the question of a militia interposed itself with the standing army and the fear of a standing army relative to what we may or may not do here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I don't mean any disrespect here, Senator Cohen, but I'd love to have lunch with you and talk about that. It's not really relevant to the bill here by Senator Champion or Senator Latz, because the court, at least for now, has decided that. I'm not making an argument about that. The right has been established, and there are limits to that right which open up possibilities for power to be exercised by the state. And so the thing that brought me in here is that having taught this course for so long and reading letters to the editor and so forth, I just sat up one morning at breakfast and said, enough is enough. There's more to the Constitution than any particular individual clauses. You know, other people spend time arguing about the Commerce Clause. We can have a long conversation about that, too.
Okay.
Well, we need to look at the entire structure we have. Government has power, which is limited, and individuals have rights, which are not absolute. That may be bad news, but that is the situation in our country.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'll wait till the lunch. So.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Professor. Thank you for your testimony. I have not yet read the Heller decision, but I will read it before this evening. But it sounds to me like in that case, from what I've heard from the two of you, you and Senator Cohen, that was not a universal background check case, that case was about a governmental unit exceeding its right and imposing unnecessary and improper restrictions on handgun use in the District of Columbia. And so wouldn't it be fair to say that whatever Justice Scalia might have been saying was in that context, we might learn from it, but it certainly doesn't have specific application authoritatively to a universal background check bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Ortman,
with all due respect, I couldn't disagree more. As a lawyer, I can only read support Supreme Court cases with a conservative attitude. What that means is looking at what they held. What they held was the District of Columbia cannot prohibit the possession of a handgun in your home. Can't do, that was the question.
Right.
And the second thing is whether or not you require people disassemble long guns in their home. That was it. What he also says, and you'll see this, he says it in the part that refers to William Blackstone, the old English jurist. He says that conditions on commercial sales, there's room for that. Now, he doesn't specify what kind of conditions, but to say that he doesn't deal with background checks, which is a condition on a sale, is not correct. It's a misreading of the case. I'm sorry. Now, the specific ones, is it Senator Champion's bill? Who else has them? I think Representative Paymar and other people. That's maybe open to some question, but you can't get any specifics from him. And what you do get is you have power to make choices about public policy that will be served, like health, safety, and welfare, by putting conditions on commercial sales. If this legislature does not put any kind of conditions on commercial sales to solve what sometimes is called the gun show loophole, it seems to me that it's basically giving up the possibility of addressing something which you clearly have power to do. And it's under, interestingly enough, the 10th Amendment, which has been revived by the Rehnquist and now the Roberts courts, which says states do have power. They're not just, you know, to be run over by the federal government.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Orban, a follow-up.
Well, I do think it's interesting that you believe that a ban that is unconstitutional somehow creates the constitutionality for a different type of provision. And so, Mr. Chair, my question would be to you. We've given 10 minutes or more to a constitutional professor who has a particular point of view and an interpretation of Supreme Court precedent, and I'm wondering if you would provide in the next 2 days the opportunity for a different point of view from a constitutional scholar.
Senator Orman, yes, I believe we'll have some time tomorrow if there's a professor who would like to present a different constitutional point of view.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer, are you a professor who wishes to present?
I am not a professor, and I'm not an attorney, Mr. Chair. But following up on Senator Ortman's comments, with all due respect to Professor Vogel, we do have another law professor in the room that might be able to give us some comment on this right now. Is that in your timetable to allow?
It was not, but I think looking for my staff person is out there dealing with procedural issues. I think we have enough flexibility because Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill is not going to be heard today. If there's another professor that would like to
Professor Olson
spend a few minutes. Professor Olson is also on the agenda to testify with regard to both of the substantive bills that will be coming up in a few minutes. So perhaps what we can do, and by the way, on that point, for Senate File 458, we are going to expand the time to 30 minutes for each side because we don't have Senator Ingebrigtsen's bill on the agenda. So how about if we leave Professor Olson's opportunity to contribute to that time frame, and if it turns a little more inquiry wants to be made along those constitutional lines, we can be flexible on that point to give him the opportunity.
Does Professor Olson have the time to? Is he going to be here?
Well, Professor Olson, you're on the agenda for the rest of the bills. I assume you'll be here for the duration of the proceeding, right?
Yes, I will be here for the remainder of today for certain.
Okay. So you're okay if we take some of those questions when we put it in that context, or would you like to address some of these issues at this moment?
I can address them at this moment. It won't take long.
Okay. Professor, why don't you go ahead and state your full name for the record then, please.
Thank you. My name is Joseph Olson. I live in Roseville. I am a professor of law at Hamline University. And for the last...
Professor, could you pull the mic closer to you, please, so we can all hear you? Thank you.
I'm a professor of law at Hamline University, and for the last 20 years, I have taught a constitutional law seminar in the Second Amendment. I have an article that was cited by the Supreme Court opinion in the Heller case, and I have filed amicus briefs both in Heller and McDonald, so I follow this issue quite closely. Howard has generally presented the matter quite accurately. However, some things we should notice. One, the Heller case did not deal with the acquisition of firearms at all. The Heller case provided that you had the right to have one. And, of course, part of having one is acquiring it. So you have the right not only to have it, but to acquire it. the kind of firearm that you can have under the Heller case, which didn't actually deal with this issue, so this is dicta as well, is a firearm that is in common use by law-abiding people in the country, which would cover a lot of things. The Heller case is absolutely silent on background checks. It wasn't an issue. They don't say anything about it. What they do talk about in dicta, and Howard's right about this, they provide that states can regulate the commercial sale of arms. However, the bill that we're going to be seeing in a while, in a short while, relates to the private sale of arms, which the Heller case does not approve state regulation of. It's simply silent on that matter. And the police power, which the state has, is, of course, regulated by the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution through the Supremacy Clause. I'm sure you're all aware that if you go on the Internet, you can see interesting pictures of human beings engaged in various activities. You can go to bookstores here in St. Paul and Minneapolis and buy literature that shows the same thing. Now, the legislature may think that is bad for the health and welfare of Minnesotans, and for years it did, and it enacted regulations, and the federal courts have finally come down and decided the First Amendment trumps the state police power. Well, in some respects, at this point undefined, the Second Amendment also trumps state police powers. It certainly trumped the state police powers of the District of Columbia, and it certainly trumped the state police powers of the City of Chicago and the State of Illinois and every other state, at least in some regards. So the issue is, I think Howard made it absolutely clear. Supreme Court said you can regulate commercial sale, but you cannot regulate private sales.
Thank you, Professor Olson. It's glad to see the diversity of opinion is alive and well at Hamline Law School.
Our offices were next to each other for 40 years.
Just as he is here, he was always to the left of me. We were right next door. And I'd be happy to respond to that. It's a brilliant recharacterization, restatement of what I said. I don't think there's anything different in there except some things I could point out if you're interested in hearing.
I think what I'd like to do, because we do have people waiting who want to make presentations on bills specifically. This has been a wonderful reminder of how exciting law school constitutional law classes were. I actually liked mine a lot. It's a fascinating topic, but I'd like to try to move on if we may, unless there's some burning question remaining among the senators at the table here. And if we have additional time tomorrow, we can certainly revisit some of these questions for discussion and input.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll add Professor Olson Senator. To lunch we're going to have. So.
Another one. For lunch?
You can make it. Can we put a recorder at the lunch table? Have both professors and Senator Cohen there, and perhaps Senator Ortman if she wishes to join. And we'll make the discussion a part of our public record. All right, professors, thank you both for your contributions to this conversation.
Thank you for the courtesy of letting us speak.
We are now going to turn to Senate File 235. Since that is my bill, I'm going to ask Senator Goodwin to come take the chair.
Senate File 235, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm pleased to present to you Senate File 235. It makes a number of changes to statutes
designed to tighten up some of the language relating to which persons are lawfully in possession of firearms, more particularly what disqualifies individuals in Minnesota from lawfully possessing firearms. Rather than have me go through the bill's substantive content, I'm going to ask Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, who put the bill together and who is sitting to my left, to go ahead and present his proposal, which he characterizes as the practical prosecutor's package to fight gun crime. And I believe the members have been provided with a copy of a summary page of these proposals as well. But Madam Chair, I'd ask County Attorney Freeman.
County Attorney Freeman, please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Freeman, the duly elected Hennepin County Attorney. First off, I'd like to thank Senator Latz for agreeing to be the chief author of this bill. It has been put together with the assistance and the support of the Urban County Attorneys and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. A number of the police organizations have endorsed it after we put it together. Very simply, there are five parts. Four of them deal with individuals who have already committed a crime of violence, and it is for their subsequent action of carrying a gun or an other instrumentality of death that we seek to have additional penalties provided. Let me explain. Certain crimes, the definition that this legislature has passed of certain crimes of violence say that you are denied the right to carry a gun at that time. And if you are found subsequently carrying a gun, that is what we call a felon in possession, and that's either a 60-month penalty or a 36-month penalty, and the second time it's a mandatory, which means we use this as a device for people who have already committed a crime of violence and they carry a gun again against a prohibition that has been upheld constitutionally. This takes them off the streets. And frankly, we find much of the serious gun violence committed by people who have previously committed a felony. But the first part of our bill here is to correct an omission that we've known about but not been able to pass in previous years, primarily for fiscal reasons. And that is certain crimes, domestic abuse violence. It's a terrible crime, and it's often committed against intimate partners. And to date, it's only a gross misdemeanor. This bill will include in the felony definition of a crime of violence domestic abuse by strangulation, felony-level domestic abuse, and fifth-degree felony assault. These are specifically designed to make sure that the first time these very serious crimes of felony of domestic abuse are caused, that the second time, or in fact if they're carrying a gun, it will be found as a crime of violence and the mandatory sentence will kick in. The second is trying to do something about juveniles and guns. Today, it's a felony for juveniles to carry guns or assault weapons. It is not a crime for juveniles to carry long guns, and because we have encouraged hunting, and that's fine. But juveniles aren't supposed to carry assault weapons or handguns. If they are found with that, they are charged, and they can be found guilty of the felony, and there is essentially no penalty. If they're found that a second time, again, essentially no penalty. And that has caused difficulties, frankly, particularly in urban areas where some of our youth have committed the crime of carrying guns over and over again. Under this bill, if this bill passes, it will allow us on a second or third time to, in essence, seek certifying it and having that juvenile treated as an adult. Moreover, this bill will also provide the situation that, let's say, a juvenile under present law has carried a gun three different times and has three different juvenile felonies. But they turn 19, they turn 18, and then their 19th birthday, they're carrying a gun again. Well, we have to start all over again in crimes of violence before we can have the opportunity in the right cases to assert the penalty of felons in possession. This would allow us, when that juvenile carries a gun as an adult, after having the juvenile carries an adult as an adult, carries a gun as an adult, and they had the previous juvenile penalty. Now, since this bill was written, there's been some suggestions that perhaps we ought to extend that not to the first time the juvenile does it, but the second time. And we're certainly willing to engage in discussions. But what I want to present to the committee today is this idea that juveniles ought to not get a free pass over and over and over again to carry a gun, because they're not allowed to. But the way the penalties work, they don't really need to pay a price. Number three is doing what we can to stop the knowing transfers of guns to felons. Again, we are not talking, this bill does not engage in the discussion about the sale of guns to lawful gun owners. But we are talking about felons. And what we see is two phenomena happening. We see in the streets that an individual is carrying a gun, and that person is carrying the gun because they're a juvenile and they don't pay a penalty. The felon, the adult felon walking down the street, says, "Give me that gun." Now, maybe they don't commit a crime with that gun, or maybe they do and we have insufficient evidence to prove it. But we want to make that transfer of a gun to a felon who is not entitled to carry a gun a crime. Aiding and abetting is what we call it in the business. It will also assist in the straw purchase on behalf of a felon, because too often we see, and frankly, male senators, we see too often girlfriends exploited into buying a gun and giving it to their boyfriend who is a felon. Well, you know, frankly, we need to stop that kind of trafficking, because none of us can really support someone purchasing a gun and giving it to a felon. That's the knowing transfer section. Finally, on these four provisions, we have the situation about trying to keep ammunition away from criminals. Often the police legitimately stop a car, and all of a sudden flying out the window on the passenger side is a handgun. And interestingly enough, all three individuals in that gun are felons, and they couldn't possess that handgun, but we can't prove who had possession of the gun. Also interestingly, all three of them have ammunition for that particular gun in their pockets. That seems to me to be folks that we ought to be able to cause consequences to, and we want the carrying of ammunition by a felon to be treated just the same way as carrying a gun. The final position that we are proposing is a clarification of law in the civil commitment process. We think this is a minor technicality, but we recognize every time you enter into the discussion of the civil commitment process, it is a delicate discussion. Let me try to explain. As members of this committee well know, we convict people who commit crimes by the legal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. There are people who are of danger to themselves or others who can be civilly committed by the standard of clear and convincing evidence. In those proceedings, in civil court, we have to prove that that person is of danger to themselves or others. Then that person can be committed and ordered to go to the state hospital. That's called a commitment. What we're in the process and the procedure, what often happens is a person is adjudicated of in danger of themselves or others, but the final order of that commitment is stayed because they can use their health insurance to go to a private facility to get treatment. That is a good thing. That is a good thing because they're using the private insurance rather than your and my tax dollars. And secondly, sometimes it's a better treatment situation for them. Presently, it is unclear whether or not that person can carry a gun. We don't believe they should, because if they're formally committed, they're not entitled to possess a handgun. And we think that item should be clarified. Now, let me suggest to members that I know that this committee is going to hear lots of other ideas from a variety of folks with a variety of viewpoints, and many of which I support and some which I do not. But we have tried to narrowly tailor this to things that we know can make a difference, giving us, meaning prosecutors, the capacity to take some folks who have already shown that they are either of danger to themselves or others or have already committed crimes of violence and do something about them. Because we find that the repeat offenders commit way too large a series of the violent crimes in the street. Madam Chair, that's our ideas, and I, again, appreciate Senator Latz for bringing this to this room and for discussion, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Are there any questions from the members at this point?
Madam Chair, if I may add.
Oh.
I have in my file a letter from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association endorsing this particular piece of legislation. It's also my understanding that other organizations representing law enforcement have also expressed their support for this piece of legislation. I think if it were not caught up in the broader gun control debate, it would pass overwhelmingly off of the Senate floor. So I'd encourage members to give strong consideration to the provisions in Senate File 235.
Thank you, Senator Latz and Senator Deedson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Latz and County Attorney Freeman. County Attorney Freeman, you were talking about when we're talking to juveniles, and I think this covers it, but then you kind of went off. So on a lot of times what we see is adults are with juveniles. So there, you might have an 18 or 20-year-old who's legally an adult with a, you know, riding in a car with a 15-year-old, and the adult, and it might even be a 12-year-old, the 20-year-old has a gun that they're a felon, so they are not legally allowed to carry that gun. And if they are stopped for a traffic stop or any type of thing, they hand that gun to the 12-year-old or the 15-year-old because that person doesn't get as strong a charge or it's not a felony. Does this address that issue at all?
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, yes, it does.
Freeman.
It does because the juvenile right now really pays no penalty. It's a felony for that juvenile to have the gun, but there's not the penalties it would for the adult if they're possessing the gun. Under this legislation, it will become much more serious for the juvenile to carry that gun. And accordingly, we're going to try to stop some of this abuse of juveniles by adult felons in the possession of guns.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, we'll have our next. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Cohen.
Yep, Madam Chair and Attorney Freeman. Relative to the transfer of guns to felons, you're looking for an absolute prohibition of any transfer to a felon. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, today, under existing state law, felons cannot possess handguns, period. So all this does is to the aiding and abetting section makes it a aiding and abetting crime for a person to give a felon a handgun if they know the person's a felon. That's going to be our charge as prosecutors. We're going to have to prove that person knew that they knew the individual they're giving the gun to was a felon at the time they give them the gun.
Madam Chair, that was my follow-up question, that this bill makes it clear that you have to have the knowledge that the person is a felon. And then it's, as you suggested, if you're going to charge that person with the crime, you'll have to that'll have to be the, among the elements of the crime itself.
Mr.
Madam
Freeman.
Chair, Senator Cohen, we're going to have to prove what was in their mind by beyond a reasonable doubt, which, as you know, as a lawyer, is not always easy to do.
Senator Godin? Any other questions? Oh, Senator Sharon.
In the incident that you described in which a felon would hand a gun other than a long gun to an adolescent, and you're increasing the penalty for that adolescent. If that adolescent states in the course of your conversation with them that they were given that gun from the felon, do you have a basis for which to address that felon?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, first, having had the opportunity to spend a lot of hours in this room, I did try to anticipate all your questions. That's one I didn't get to. Because I think what you're asking me is the felon, the adult felon committing their own crime by giving the handgun to the juvenile. I can't, Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, Senator Sharon, you asked me a good question, and frankly, right now I can't answer it.
We better move on to the opponents. Senator Latz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would just ask, add one thing. I suspect in that situation, Senator Sharon, that evidence from the juvenile could possibly be used as a basis for charging the adult felon with illegal possession of a firearm, separate from the act of transferring the firearm to the juvenile. But that would, be a matter of proof.
Thank you. Now we'll have the Professor Joe Olson and Andrew Rothman both come up at the same time because they're both with the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, if that's okay. 3 minutes for each.
Madam Chair, I think the way we have the agenda set up, then there will be 20 minutes for the those listed as the opponents on the bill, and they would have a total of 20 minutes to divide however they wish however to they among wish. The individuals listed as witnesses.
Okay, Senator Lass, thank you.
Madam Chairman, Senator, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm here today in my capacity as the president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. We have been working with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with regard to this bill. I believe that we have an agreement that will eliminate our concerns. And so at this point, we have no objections to the bill.
Thank you, Professor Olson. Andrew Rothman is not going to speak now. Okay, Greg Dahlstrom? Not going to speak. Okay, David Gross?
Madam Chair, Andrew Rothman. None of the planned testifiers have any objection to this bill.
Oh, wow. Okay. We've got some unanimity here.
Madam Chair, then I ask that the chair lay this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus.
Madam
bill.
Chair, oh. I have. Thank you. I had a conversation, Senator Sharon and I had a conversation with counsel relating to her question, which I was going to follow up on, and so I'd like him to respond. Oh. And this has to do with. How do you get at the adult felon who hands the gun to the juvenile? So, you know, the juvenile lots of times feels threatened and that they have to take that gun. And so how can we, you know, is this a crime or can we use that transfer to get further crime against the or further penalties against the felon who passes that off? And so I'd like the council to address that.
Madam Chair, members. I believe that conduct would already be a crime under current law. 624.7141 would be if a person transfers a pistol intentionally to someone, among others, who is disqualified under 624.713 from possessing. So that would apply. And then I believe if Section 4 of the bill relating to aiding and abetting were enacted, I assume that would apply as well then.
Any other questions before we... Okay, Senate File 235 will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, now that we've established a pattern of unanimity on the proposals before the committee, we will turn to Senate File 458. Is Senator Champion in the room?
Yes.
Oh, there we are. Senator Champion, please come forward. And welcome to the committee, Senator. I understand that you have an author's amendment for this bill. Is that correct, Senator Champion?
That's right, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for hearing my bill today.
You're welcome. Let's make sure that we all have the author's amendment available to us in our packets. Yeah.
from it.
It's not in my packet, Mr. Chair.
Members, I think you should have the A13-0067 amendment in your packet. Senator Champion, is that your author's amendment?
That is my author's amendment, Mr. Chair. Would you like for me to go through it?
In just a moment, as this is your first committee, it is the typical procedure in the Senate, for those who are not familiar, that an author is allowed to make an amendment at their first committee to put the bill in the shape that they wish it to be considered in. So as a courtesy, we typically just go ahead and do that. So we'll go ahead and Senator Sharon moves the A13-67 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Champion, it's your bill. Go ahead and explain your bill, if you will, and for those who you wish to have testify, we have a total of 30 minutes set aside for the proponents, so you can all use it as you wish, but I will cut you off after 30 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to try to be as brief as possible. I think it's important, though, Mr. Chair, to quickly demonstrate to the committee what changes have been made in the bill, and then once I've done that, then I will launch into my recitation. First of all, on page 1, line 15, we delete the new language, so it no longer says "or other lawful firearms," because we wanted it to be very clear that we are only talking about pistols and or semi-automatic military-style weapons only. Also, if you look on page 6.
And Senator Champion, that provision applies to persons under the age of 18.
Absolutely. And if you look on page 6, Mr. Chair, we are deleting section 7 and section 8. Section 7 deals primarily with a permit to carry. What we did not want to have happen is once a person has been given the permit to carry, we did not want them to have to come back every single year and get a background check or anything run of that particular nature. So we wanted to make sure that there was clarity. So we are deleting the new language in Section 7 and Section 8. And also, if you look at page 8, we are simply asking for, on line 27, we are simply asking that this information be inserted that really provides clarity for auctioneers, because we know that there was a concern that auctioneers are merely facilitating a sale, but neither is the owner nor the seller. And so we wanted to make sure that we could subside their or address their concerns and make sure that that was addressed. Page 9. Again, for report purposes, transfer reports, we are asking for that new language in Section 15 to be deleted as well. And this particular bill then would be in the shape that we're asking. Mr. Chair, what is clear is that this particular bill is really about background checks, and background checks are the only systematic way to stop people from buying firearms who are not allowed to have them, and to be able to stop the gun trafficking that plagues our communities. But federal and state law only requires background checks for gun sales at licensed dealers. Federal law requires a background check through the federal system before each gun sale from a dealer. We know that there are gaps in that system. We know that our state fills in many of these gaps and keeps the public safer. There was an attempt 2 years ago to repeal our state law, which requires a locally conducted background check for sales of pistols and assault weapons from dealers. Testimony from the Brooklyn Park Police Department showed that of all of the permits to purchase that were denied a previous year, every single one was because of the local background check. Not the federal one. Our local law enforcement is finding the restraining orders, domestic violence convictions, commitments, and other red flags that are not caught by the federal system. We propose to extend the background check to cover all gun sales, not just those at federally licensed dealers. Some claim that this is registration. It is not registration. We don't have registration of guns under current law. All this bill does is to extend our current law to cover more transactions. For an example, when someone buys a gun from a dealer today, the federal government's records of that sale must be destroyed within 24 hours. The government retains a transaction number. If the gun turns up in a crime, the FBI has to call the dealer to find out who originally bought the gun with that transaction number. This will make illegal the practice of selling guns with no background checks at gun shows, online for in-state sales, and at venues like garage sales and other private sales. All of these paths are exploited by gun traffickers. And the illegal guns end up on our streets. And being a person who represents the city of Minneapolis, I understand that this is a real problem. There is, in this bill, just so folks are clear, there is an exemption on the background check requirement for family members, as long as they are not prohibited from owning a firearm. It also gives law enforcement more time to confirm the applicant's identity and records, up to 30 days, which is the period sheriffs have to do the same checking for permits to carry. It also requires the applicant to appear in person with an ID if there is a doubt about their identity, and if needed, to submit fingerprints. This would likely have prevented, there was a situation with the person by the name of Kristen Oberender, a mentally ill and dangerous person featured in a Star Tribune article, from getting a gun permit by reversing his first and middle name on the application. The penalty is a gross misdemeanor for the first offense, then felony. The additional new language about a felony penalty if the gun is used in a crime is actually existing law. Just move to this particular, well, we just moved the section we are proposing to. This bill also restores the ability of law enforcement to deny permits to purchase guns to people they believe pose a danger to themselves or others. We are working with NAMI on language that does this while addressing NAMI's concerns. That language will be included in the final version of this bill. And why that's very important from my vantage point is because we do not want to hamper or prevent individuals who may need some mental health services from receiving those services. And we understand that there's an important balance, and we want to be as respectful as possible because we do not want to continue to stigmatize individuals receiving mental health services. I also have a minor amendment to clarify the role of auctioneers, which I've already put there, and I've also talked about the other amendments that have happened. But background checks laws were found by a 2004 National Academy of Sciences Review of Research to be an important disruptor of gun trafficking channels. Since the federal background checks was enacted, merely 2 million gun purchases have been stopped by federal background checks. The abusive husband who killed his wife and several others at a Wisconsin spa last summer was a prohibited buyer because of his violent history. But he went online and bought a gun. It is legal in Minnesota to buy a gun that way without a background check, just as it is in Wisconsin. The way to screen more effectively for mental illness or violent people is to make sure that each sale requires a background check. And lastly, I would like to end by saying, and then I would be happy to have my other testifiers come up. Recent polling shows an overwhelming majority of Americans support this measure, including 3 out of 4 NRA members. 80% to 90% of Minnesotans support it as well. It is merely an opportunity for us to try to make sure that individuals who should not have guns not have them. And I did say lastly, but I'll also say this because I want to continue to make my father proud because he is a hunter. He is one who owns guns as well. This is a great balance by making sure that my father and others like him are able to hunt and do everything that they do on a regular basis, but we also want to make sure that we are not allowing guns to fall into the hands of the wrong people. And this is my sincere attempt in order to do that. So with that, I do have a couple testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Champion. I just will note there are 22 minutes remaining in this portion of the hearing, and I'll let you determine the order in which you have your testifiers come forward. And please make sure you identify your names for the recording and sign in when you get an opportunity. Senator Ortman?
May I ask the author a couple of questions about his intent?
Senator Ortman,
about the amendment?
What we're going to do is when we there will be a provision for time for discussion among the senators, and we can ask questions of anyone we want to after both sides have had their equal time to make the presentations. It's going to be nearly impossible for me to keep track of how long questions and answers are without and still be fair to each side.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to understand the bill. I mean, it's just a basic question about the amendment.
Senator Ortman, real quickly then, please.
Line 1.3, Mr. Chair, refers to page 6, deleting section 7 and 8. And Senator Champion, are you deleting all reference from those provisions of law in this bill, or are you deleting your changes? I just want to make sure we all understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I'm only deleting the changes that we were originally proposing.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Champion, go ahead and we'll add a minute to your time.
And I did.
Your witnesses.
Yes, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And for us, this session is dedicated not to guns, but to preventing certain individuals from accessing them. We hope you'll at least agree from the start that there are certain people that just simply should not have them. We also hope you agree with us that now is the time for us to do more to prevent criminals and people experiencing mental illness issues from obtaining them. This bill will go a long way to helping those efforts. In fact, most of the bills you're going to discuss over the next few days will help law enforcement in many different ways and will have an impact on gun violence. You've all heard the term closing the gun show loophole. Well, we would submit that it's not really a loophole but a huge gaping hole that allows as many as 40% of the gun transactions in our state to take place through private sales, such as on the internet, over the backyard fence, out of trunks of cars, etc. And all these sales are conducted by people who do not transact their business through a federal licensed dealer and have not obtained the necessary transfer permit that is required by law, and most importantly, do not undergo a police background check. That's the hole this bill attempts to close. It is the route that people who know they are ineligible to pass a background will travel. Right now, we offer two distinct routes for a person wanting a handgun. One route requires a police background check that may take up to 7 days, or the other that allows an immediate sale with no questions asked. There should be no question in your mind where the people are going that I know you do not want to have guns. This is what has to stop, and we feel this bill will do just that. This is not just supported by law enforcement, and make no mistake, it is indeed supported by them, but polls as recently as last month showing strong public support in trying to ensure that ineligible people cannot easily obtain handguns. This position has been consistently supported and, frankly, is long overdue. Background checks are universally supported by sportsmen and hunters as well as the general public, and they do work. You will hear testimony today on that. This bill simply closes the door to so many that should not have a handgun. It's sensible, reasonable, and it will work. It still allows transactions to be made by private parties, neighbors, and friends, but it just requires the buyer to go to their police department and obtain a permit and then conduct the transaction through a federally licensed dealer. It allows police to initially deny a permit to those that they know have been confined for mental illness reasons. That decision, like all permit decisions, can later be appealed, and if the court, after receiving advice from mental health professionals, feels those problems no longer exist, the permit can be issued. I was reading a snippet about a study that was conducted in 2004 by Johns Hopkins University involving a national representative survey of state prison inmates who were incarcerated for committing crimes involving a gun. And this survey found that only 9.9% of them actually got their gun from stealing it, as most people want us to believe, while over 80% reported getting it from a transaction with an unlicensed private seller. Make no mistake about it, we're not doing enough to protect the citizens of our state from gun violence. The weakness in our laws is the reason many people obtain guns. We are not doing enough to prevent people who, for a host of reasons, simply should not possess a handgun from getting them. This is the public safety bill of the session. I strongly urge you to join virtually all of law enforcement to support this measure. We have a number of people that are going to come up here from law enforcement. I'm going to start with a detective from the Brooklyn Park Police Department who actually does this for a living, and that is that he does background checks on applicants for permits to acquire or transfer permits.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having me here today.
Sir, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Mark Bergeron. I'm a police sergeant with the City of Brooklyn Park. I've been a licensed police officer in Minnesota for almost 17 years. My duties include, at the police department, they include the permit purchase process. And I was asked to come here today to give a little background for the senators as to exactly what the process entails at a police department, in case you had questions about that. And I'll begin by telling you that how the process works with the Brooklyn Park Police Department. When citizens come in, they apply in person, they provide their identification, and most people have an application already filled out that they've downloaded offline. They're given a receipt as required by law, and then we accept the application and begin the checks. The police department conducts checks utilizing the BCA computer system, which is connected to the FBI. We are able to run criminal history background checks on through the state arrest records and through the federal arrest records. The check also runs through the NICS, the National Instant Check System that the FFLs use. It also checks through the Department of Human Services for what we call potential name matches. If we get a hit on a potential name match, then we fax a release to the Department of Human Services, and they do an internal records check to see if the name is an exact match. And then we also check the Minnesota driver's license database. And then, as required in the law, we also check what's called local records. The local record check with the Brooklyn Park Police Department is where, as a person authorizing the permits, sometimes run into the stumbling blocks. Many of the federal and state checks, it's very clear if there's a conviction or not and what the status should be. But one such example I'll give is in 2012, I had a check on the local records, and with the Brooklyn Park Police Department, we had on file that just about 3 months prior to this applicant making their application for a permit, they had ingested a large quantity of pills and slit their wrists in an attempt to commit suicide. They told their family member if they had a handgun, they would shoot themselves. Now that person was making an application to purchase a firearm. It's very difficult to act in good faith and grant that permit. Also in 2012, we had an applicant that applied for a firearm, and we were unable to grant them because during the local records check, between the time they applied and when we were going to grant it, we found out that they were now deceased as a result of suicide. Thank you if you have any questions.
Thank you, Investigator.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, before I have more law enforcement come forward, I will ask the mayor of the great city of Minneapolis, R.T. Ryback, to come and provide some testimony.
Please sign. Mr. Rybick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Knowing our time is short, I will be very brief, but I absolutely appreciate you doing this. On my way here this morning, I left my office and went to get a sandwich quickly. I walked through the tunnel, through the Skyway to get a sandwich, and passed through the Hennepin County Government Center, which is a pretty normal thing for anyone to do. But that walk is never normal for me. It certainly hasn't been since 2003, because of that day, the whole building changed very much for many people. That was the day that Susan Berkowitz came into that building. She was involved in a very complicated suit with her cousin. She killed her cousin and her cousin's attorney. She bought that gun from a gun show. It was a 100-year-old revolver that she bought with no background check. That's one of scores of examples around the state of Minnesota where horrible, hideous crimes have occurred with guns that have been purchased by people without any background whatsoever. If you think this is only isolated to Minneapolis, go 140 miles north up to Cass County to Pillager. There was a man up there who had a garage sale. People can have garage sales, but what he did is he went to garage sales all around northern Minnesota, bought up guns, and consistently had one garage sale after the other, selling guns with, of course, no background checks. And our police have very strong reason to believe that some of the people involved in criminal activity in our city were getting guns there, and they were coming back and flooding the streets of Minneapolis. Now, we do have background checks in the country right now. We have some federal background checks. The information on how those work is sketchy because there are some federal laws that prohibit us as local officials from getting access to federal information. But we do generally know this. 2009 is a good year for the data that we have. There were about 150,000 people who were stopped with the background checks of that. That's about 1% of the people who bought guns who were prevented from doing it because of background checks. If you think about that, and you think about the fact that 40% of the people right now who are buying guns are not getting a background check, you can recognize that there is a common understanding across all ideologies that there are simply some people who should not own guns through the case of their mental illness, through the domestic abuse issues, and through multiple other issues. We've made a judgment in this country that some people should have background checks. The only issue at stake here is whether that's enforced universally or arbitrarily, so 60% of the people have background checks and 40% of them do not. Each of us bring our own personal experience to this issue. It's one of the reasons why this is obviously so difficult on so many levels and is so polarizing. The personal experience I bring is as someone who sadly has been to more funerals than I can count for far too many children, met far too many parents who've lost loved ones. I've been to a lot of scenes where there's been a lot of death, and I don't naively come to you and say that passing this or passing any law here will solely be accountable for ending all gun violence in this country. Sadly, that's naive. It involves many different things, mental health issues, youth violence prevention issues, opportunity issues, poverty issues. We're working aggressively in all of those areas, and I'm proud to say that our city has dramatically reduced gun violence. But I also know that, sadly, there are people in this state and in my city who have died at the hands of guns that have gone without any background check. We know that there's a reason to do that. We've done it before. And I ask you, if you go to an airport, if you knew that 40% of the people who were getting on that plane didn't go through the security, wouldn't that make you a little less likely to fly? All we're asking if this is that background checks be applied universally and in the name of preventing gun violence and in a strategy that I believe we can all unite behind, I ask you to support this provision in the bill.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Behan, currently the Chief of Police, City of Rogers, 33 years in law enforcement, 14 of those as a chief, previously the chief in Elk River. I'll be brief.
Thank you. I'll just before you do that, I'll just let folks know you've got about 9 minutes left for this portion of the testimony for all of them.
One of the things that the Chiefs Association would like to make clear is there's a tremendous gap between what's allowed by federal and state law, those that are convicted felons, and those that have been committed or court ordered to an institution for chemical dependency or mental illness. In our communities, we feel that we have a right to protect our cities based on knowledge that our police departments have. I want to point out that perhaps in our brief testimony here can be misinterpreted that someone who has gone to the hospital once for a mental crisis or has been deemed by their doctor to be mentally ill, these are not the people we're talking about. We're talking about people that we have multiple calls for service to their residences, maybe 60 to 100, where they suffer from physical, cognitive, emotional, substance abuse, suicidal tendencies, homicidal tendencies. Someone could make a statement that they're going to kill someone, but they haven't identified a victim. They just need a means. They make these comments for months, for years, and eventually they show up at our door, and they're not excluded from getting a permit to acquire, but we have extreme concerns about doing that. A specific case that I'll mention, an individual in our community who passed away last week at 92 years of age, last stages of severe dementia. In the last year of his life, his family took his firearms away because he began to reflect back on his time in the Pacific War, where he started to realize or thought he realized that family members were the enemy. And when they came into the house, he no longer recognized his wife, his grandchildren, and others. He did show up at our door about a year ago and wanted a permit to acquire. We have great concern, even though he meets that criteria, to be able to give a permit to acquire to that individual. We're asking for the 2009 legal latitude that we had under the statute, where based on the totality of the circumstances, the extreme number of calls and things that are said, evidence that is brought to us that is court defensible, that the chiefs be allowed to say that in spite of the non-commitment or the non-felony conviction, that we have extreme concerns. And I'll leave you with this. I have processed thousands of permits to acquire very efficiently and very effectively. I believe it's my duty to do that and to get these permits to those that deserve them. I'm suggesting that in all my 14 years of being a chief, that maybe one, two, or possibly three of all those thousands would have met this extreme criteria of me looking at that case saying that this person is a danger to our community, and I have an obligation as chief to protect the community first and to potentially deny this individual from possessing that permit. So make it clear, we're not talking about someone who's had a singular incident or maybe even five or six, but based on the totality of what is being said, the threats that they've made, and the other evidence that we've gathered, this person should not possess a permit to acquire. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. I've just been informed that we actually have the room until 3 p.m., which is a little bit longer than I had thought. So I'm going to make an executive decision here, and each side's times will be extended by 5 minutes so that we can make sure everyone who will do our best to accommodate all the testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohn.
If I can ask a quick question, hopefully it doesn't count against the time.
Yes.
Chief, just a quick question, if I might. From the time you get the permit until you issue the issue the permit, or the application for permit, to the time you issue the permit, what's roughly the length of time?
Chief?
Chairman and members of the committee, we've been able to turn around permits in just a day and a half, but on average for us, based on the numbers getting right now, it's 3 to 5 days.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chief.
Sir?
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Chief Kevin Benner from the Brooklyn Center Police Department, and what I'm here to testify is in regards to a real case that happened 1 year and 9 days ago in the city of Brooklyn Center. I believe this case is very relevant to the bill that's before you, and I think had this bill been passed 1 year and 10 days ago, we would not have seen this case happen. Rochelle Inselman had a hate for a Brett Strzok 5 years ago prior to her murdering him and convicted in 2012 of that murder. Rochelle Inselman had plotted for several months how she was going to extract a revenge in a relationship that went bad 5 years ago. She is a prohibited person from carrying a firearm by state law because she had a restraining order for her against her ex-husband, not the victim in this case, and violating that restraining order 6 times. On December 2nd, 2011, she went to the Eden Valley Police Department and attempted to purchase or acquire a permit to acquire. On December 8th, 2011, the police department did their diligence. They found that she was not eligible to receive that permit to acquire, and they denied that permit. Rochelle Inselman was now struggling with the challenge in front of her. She had tremendous internet skills, and she had to choose from thousands of different guns that she could purchase in the state of Minnesota on armslist.com and many other websites that she chose. She did find armslist.com. She found a person that would sell her handgun, one of many, and she purchased that firearm. That person that sold that gun didn't know what her intention was and was not obligated to see if she had a permit to acquire. He sold that gun, abiding by all laws in Minnesota. She purchased that gun illegally, but he didn't know that. After buying that gun, she directly went to his house in the city of Brooklyn Center and shot him with every round that was provided with that gun that she purchased. She admitted to this crime, and she was convicted. But my concern that I have here is that this could have been prevented. The person that sold that gun now has to live with something. And this is something he takes serious. He sold a gun to a person that killed another person. All he needed was guidance. What were the rules? If the rule would have been you had to have a permit and identification going along with that permit, or there was a transaction, he would have abided by that. And this crime, this tragedy in Brooklyn Center, the homicide of Brooklyn Center 1, would not have existed. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Schnell, Chief of Police for the City of Hastings, also a board member of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to in support of this bill. I want to highlight this by illustrating a similar case and circumstance. Few months ago in the City of Hastings, we had a man who came forward with a mental health crisis. And central to that man's mental health crisis was a whole lot of paranoia that included the use of a firearm and the carrying of a firearm. This man ultimately had previously had a permit and did have that gun lawfully. During the course of this crisis, he was ultimately placed on an emergency hold. He was transported to a local hospital where he was held. As was talked about earlier by another person testifying, he was not subjected to a commitment. His commitment was, in fact, stayed. Shortly after that man's release from the hospital and that stayed commitment, he returned to the city, to our department, and requested full and immediate release of all the guns that have been turned into us by members of his family. This request and the challenges that we faced were despite the fact that many of his family members and others who were the subject of his paranoid delusions requested that he not get these guns back, the law as it currently exists makes it very difficult for us to maintain or hold these guns. The reality is, certainly in law enforcement, we fully support, and I think as NAMI mentioned, we fully support every effort and any effort there is to provide more and improved services for persons who suffer from mental illness in our communities. But the reality is we need to be able to utilize the experience and the opportunities that we've had to deal with these people in our communities, look at the records that we have, and make decisions about their inability to possess that and provide them with reasonable due process rights to have that looked at should they disagree with the decision that we make. This is the case before us today, I think, is establishing clarity. And this bill, I think, does establish higher degrees of clarity for us in the determination of granting permits to acquire. And ultimately, it gives law enforcement more time to allow and process these applications. So we stand today in support of this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Chief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, nothing prepares you to hear the news that your father has been murdered with a gun. On September 27, 2012, I was taking a bus by myself to go visit the University of Wisconsin. My mom dropped me at the bus at roughly 4 p.m. that day. About 30 minutes later, I saw an early report of a shooting in the Bryn Mawr neighborhood of Minneapolis, where my father had built his business. My father was an immigrant living the American dream, extremely proud that all of his products and materials were bought and produced in the USA. He created dozens of jobs over the years, invented a system of Braille that made it easier for blind people to read, and exported signs all over the world, including, as he loved to tell people, China. I sent a text message to my dad telling him that I had heard there had been a shooting in the Bryn Mawr neighborhood and to be careful. This text would go unanswered because just shortly before, he had been shot twice in the head at the company he had built. This is something I will know when I go to bed every night and wake up knowing every day. The gunman killed 6 fathers that day, leaving behind their children far too soon. And while mass murders like the ones at Axe and Signage or in Newtown, Aurora, Oak Creek, Tucson,
or Virginia Tech, and many more are heartbreaking and seem to catch our attention in a more serious way. We are experiencing something many people have called slow-motion mass murder. While legislation cannot prevent every death from gun violence, legislators have a moral obligation to attempt to save as many lives as possible. By passing this legislation, I'm confident we'd be preventing some Minnesotans from receiving the call that is dreaded most, that their father or mother, brother or sister, spouse or child will not be coming home that day. I want my father's story told so other families will not have to go through the same devastation when it is often preventable through sensible gun violence prevention legislation. My dad lived the American dream but died the American nightmare. Gun violence kills 33 Americans every single day, and more than 12,000 Americans will be murdered with guns over the next year if you do not take action. We are just a very real and very scary anomaly among other first world countries. We cannot continue to be complacent with being the leading country in gun-related homicides. Enough is enough, and it's time to work for an end to gun violence to prevent another family from going through what mine has. Imagine yourself sending that text to your son or daughter, husband or wife, that goes unanswered, receiving the dreaded phone call about a loved one. We have the power to save lives. Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, that was Sammy Rahamim, and I think I can speak on behalf of the whole committee when I say we offer our condolences on your loss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Champion, you have 3 minutes left. Does anyone else you'd like to have testify?
Mr. Chair, no. I just want to say that I think the testimony that you've heard or the presentations put forward, I think, represents a cross-section of Minnesotans and those who believe in the Second Amendment as well. We just want to make sure that there are safeguards in place in order to make sure that guns do not fall in the hands of individuals who should not have them. So with that, I'll be happy to.
Thank you. Senator, I did receive a note that a Victoria Safford and a Mary Lewis Groh were to be added to the witness list for the proponents. Were they part of your presentation? And I also had Dave Petchia on the list.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Those individuals want to present. Okay, I'm seeing one person come forward. Please identify yourself. Okay, here we have two. 2 minutes remaining now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Lewis Groh, and I'm here representing the State League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters strongly supports Senate File 458, a bill that would go a long way towards preventing firearms from falling in the wrong hands. League takes its positions only after a year-long study in which all local leagues take part and after statewide consensus is reached by our members. When I first moved to Minnesota, I became acquainted with the term the Minnesota model. It was something that made me very proud that my adopted state had provided a model for the rest of the country on healthcare innovations, education, and our quality of life, and incidentally, women's studies. I worked at the Center for Research on Women at Wellesley, and people there told me I was moving to a state which had really innovated in that field. In 1994, Minnesota passed the first law in the country denying a gun permit to those convicted of domestic assault. National groups, including the Brady Campaign, had said it would be impossible to come up with such legislation since domestic assault was not a felony, and only felony-level offenses could be used to deny someone a gun purchase.
Ma'am, I'm just going to notify you there's 1 minute left.
Oh, sorry. Okay. But we
did, and the other witness as well.
We expanded the definition of prohibited purchasers to include fifth-degree domestic assault. That bill passed the Minnesota legislature with only one dissenting vote. It subsequently became the model for federal legislation. It will tarnish this state's reputation for national leadership if we fail to respond to the firearm tragedies of this last year. It's been said that no law will be perfect, but the guarantee of perfect adherence has never been the standard for passing good laws. The cost of doing nothing is continuing our shameful rate of gun deaths. It is a system where criminals and terrorists can easily buy guns through loopholes. More mass murders and shootings are the cost of doing nothing. Please vote with the majority of people in this state who think that business as usual just isn't working. More of the same is an inadequate response to a problem that dehumanizes all of us. It's time to let firearms.
Tom, I have to cut you off. Okay. I'm sorry, there's no more time for the remaining witness. Senator Champion, thank you.
Oh. Thank you.
Senator Latz.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, could I ask, could I make a quick statement to?
Senator Goodwin, we will have time after the opponents make their presentation for committee discussion.
Excellent. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The opponents of the bill, you have 35 minutes. It's now, we'll call it 2:03. You have until 2:38 to use the time as you wish, and I will give you all the same courtesy of some markers along the way so you can try to utilize your time wisely. Sir, please identify yourself for the record and welcome to the committee, Mr. Rager.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chris Rager. I'm with the National Rifle Association. The NRA strongly opposes Senate File 458, and I'm going to focus my comments on two provisions of the bill, and I know there will be other folks who will fill in the gaps there. First, I'm going to start with the mental health disqualifications. The bill would strongly expand firearm prohibitions that currently apply only to people who have been committed after a judicial determination to all such persons who have been confined or hospitalized for treatment, whether or not any judicial or other official determination of their need for treatment has been made. These new disabilities would be permanent unless the person successfully petitioned for the restoration of their rights. We oppose such expansions for a number of reasons. First, they impose a retroactive prohibition on a fundamental right without any due process. A person who had sought voluntary treatment would suddenly become prohibited without any chance to challenge the determination before the fact. Second, these provisions discourage people from voluntarily seeking treatment they may need by imposing a penalty for doing so. So an individual who, for instance, may have had an eating disorder and was hospitalized for that eating disorder, under the language of this bill, no matter how many years ago that had happened, could potentially be denied the right to possess a firearm. And that would be the same for individuals who have recently served in Iraq and Afghanistan who voluntarily sought help for PTSD or other issues along those lines. So you're setting up a system where individuals have to make a determination of whether or not they get help for their conditions or they give up their right to own a firearm. And third, I think the provisions would create an unjustifiable stigma around people who seek help for mental health or substance abuse problems. The NRA doesn't object to states conforming their own mental health standards to the federal standards, which require formal and involuntary commitment or adjudication before the fact. Next, the second thing I'd like to talk about are the provisions within the bill that deal with the banning of the private sale of firearms. The bill would unnecessarily abolish private transfers of handguns and certain semi-automatic weapons and limit such transfers to federally licensed firearm dealers. This ban would, without seeking out a FFL background check, would ban the usual trades or private sales at your local gun clubs. It would ban you from selling a firearm to your long-term neighbor. By the definition of relative, unless Senator Champion can correct me, there's no exception for even a spouse or an aunt, an uncle, or cousin, any people along those lines. This bill would also allow for a new tax or fee of up to $25 on any transfer that takes place. And also, almost bizarrely, it would remove the existing exemptions for background checks on antique firearms. As many of you may know, antique firearms aren't regulated by the federal government, so you can't actually run a background check on an antique firearm. But let me get down to some of the things I've heard here among other testifiers. There was a question as to why don't gun owners support what's called the so-called universal background checks or the private sales bans. And I think there's one overarching reason, and a lot of the folks just don't want their firearms tracked, taxed, or taken. And let me also address a few of the things I heard from Senator Champion and others. The comment was made that 74% of NRA members support a private sales ban. Well, I actually brought the only official poll that's been done of NRA members out there, a national poll that was done in January 2013, And actually, 91% of NRA members opposed the ban on private sales.
Mr. Rager, if you'd like to submit that for the record, we'll make it a part of the committee's public record at the hearing.
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Also, I heard the gun control supporters mention that 40% of firearms are purchased without background checks. And the study that they're referencing actually was done 2 decades ago prior to the implementation of the federal background check system. And that study actually came out and said 36%. So that wasn't actually 40%. But the way that they arrived at that 36% number was that they inflated the statistic wrongly to include inheritances and gifting of firearms. And in reality, the number of firearms sold without a background check, studies say, is likely under 10%. So well over 85-90+% of firearms do go through a background check. And I think I also heard someone mention that background checks have stopped 1.5 million people from purchasing a firearm in the last 14 years. Well, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, 94% of those initial denials were dropped after preliminary reviews. Almost all of the rest were dropped after extended review, and only 62 people, or just 0.1%, were prosecuted for attempting to purchase a firearm. I've also heard the term thrown around loophole. There is no private sales loophole. Americans have always been allowed to occasionally sell or trade firearms through private transfers in accordance with state and federal laws. Private sales are the exception, and they're not the rule. It's important to note that firearm ownership is at an all-time high in America, and violent crime is at an all-time low. Universal background checks aren't universal. Criminals will not submit to background checks. Only law-abiding individuals are impacted by these regulations. Not surprisingly, despite extensive research, no study has shown that expanded background checks lead to a reduction in violent crime. Universal background checks would not only be an inconvenience for some law-abiding citizens, the delays and complications could lead to increases in violent crime. You can look at the provisions in this bill and see that this is, in fact, not a universal background check because there are certain individuals that are exempted from any sort of background check. Universal background checks are unenforceable and lead to registration. The Obama administration, in a January 2013 report, admitted that the effectiveness of a universal background check depends on requiring gun registration. So the state or federal government would need a universal registration system to track the transfer of every firearm for these provisions to be effective. And I have a hard time believing that any poll that you're going to cite out there is going to show that Minnesotans support any type of full-scale universal registration scheme. Also, without a state registration scheme, as I think a few have mentioned, state authorities would be unable to determine if an individual had a background check for a particular firearm unless the firearm was used in a crime or was part of an official investigation. Let me narrow the focus for a minute to gun shows. That was also brought up as part of the proponent's testimony. Like I said, there's no private sales loophole, and there is no gun show loophole. Under current federal law, it's illegal to engage in the business of dealing in firearms without a license. From the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, anybody that's engaged in the business means buying and selling firearms as a regular business with the objective of profit. Violations carry a 5-year prison sentence and a $250,000 fine. So people who engage in a business without a license can be arrested and convicted of a federal felony, whether they engage in business at a gun show, or out of their home, office, or a vehicle. It's also important to know that gun shows are not the source of crime guns. A 2006 FBI study of criminals who attacked law enforcement officers found that within their sample, none of the attackers' rifles, shotguns, or handguns were obtained from gun shows or related activities. 97% of the guns in the study were obtained illegally, and the assailants interviewed had nothing but contempt for gun laws. A Bureau of Justice statistics report on firearms use by offenders found that less than 1% of U.S. crime guns came from gun shows, with repeat offenders even less likely than first-timers to buy guns from any retail source. This 2001 study was based on interviews with 18,000 state prison inmates and is the largest such study ever conducted by the government. So where are criminals getting guns? Another Bureau of Justice Statistics survey of state prison inmates convicted of firearm crimes found that almost 80% acquired firearms from street illegal sources or friends and family. This includes theft of firearms, black market purchases of stolen firearms, and straw purchases. Also, I think it's important that we understand that it's already a felony to be engaged in the business of buying and selling firearms and ammunition without a federal firearms dealer's license. It is already a crime for a federally licensed dealer to sell without doing a background check. That's all dealers everywhere, including retail stores, gun shows, flea markets, or anywhere else. Further, it's already a felony to sell, trade, give, lend, rent, or transfer a gun to a person you know or should have known is not legally allowed to own, purchase, or possess a firearm. The penalty for selling a gun to a person who's a criminal, who's mentally ill, mentally incompetent, or an alcohol or drug abuser is a 10-year federal felony. That's now today with no changes to the law. Finally, I think it's important to mention that criminalizing private transfers through a system of so-called universal background checks would not have prevented any of the tragedies that have spurred the call for such legislation. Even if accomplished by a change to create universal registration, most criminal possession of firearms would remain outside of such a system. So I think I would leave the committee with, I think it's important that we move forward in working on real solutions, for instance, like cracking down on straw purchases and strengthening the sharing of records between the state criminal databases and the NICS background check systems. And I definitely appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rager. There are 23 minutes remaining in the presentation for this side. Go ahead, please, sir, and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you very much. My name is Kevin Vick. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today. I am the owner and president of Crucible Arms, a federal firearm licensee dealer operating in Lakeville, Minnesota. I sell and transfer firearms to Minnesotans in accordance with existing laws. This includes a purchaser providing valid government-issued identification, a permit to purchase or a permit to carry, and utilization of the FBI National Instant Background Check System, otherwise known as NICS. This bill, as you know, would utilize the same process in an expanded capacity to include all legal private transfers of these firearms. Private transfers, as has been cited, consist of less than 10% of total firearm transfers. The intentionally misleading 40% figure being bandied about is simply a falsehood. That grossly inflated number, as has been said, was based solely on a 20-year-old survey, and more importantly, was conducted prior to the establishment of our current NICS system. If you eliminate inheritance and the passing down of heirlooms to family members, the number of firearm transfers not subject to the NICS check is approximately 10%. The overwhelming majority of firearm transfers are done through NICS background check system, including gun show sales. As has been said, the gun show loophole is also a fallacy. 98% of firearm sales at gun shows go through people like me, FFL dealers, and they are subject to NICS checks. The balance are private transfers between private citizens and is included in the 10% this bill seeks to address. So, even if it's only 10%, wouldn't it be better for public safety if we applied a universal background check to these transfers? As someone who works with the NICS background check system on a regular basis, let me tell you why this bill will have minimal, if any, impact on deterring gun crime. The current NICS system relies on voluntary compliance by all states to provide current, accurate data to the system. This is generally unfunded by the federal government or the states. Here is a result of this voluntary unfunded effort. FBI Assistant Director of the Criminal Justice Information Services Division, David Cuthbertson, in his U.S. State Senate testimony stated, quote, "Several continuing challenges and obstacles have been reported. Among these challenges are limitations including the manpower to accomplish the added duties and responsibilities associated with the management and maintenance of information submitted to the NICS. Other issues identified include outdated information technology and the inability to submit records electronically," unquote. As has been testified earlier today, background checks need to be meaningful. I agree with that completely. Limited resources, however, results in gaps and omissions in the NICS database system. These gaps and omissions are significant. In a study commissioned by Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which includes members Minneapolis Mayor Ryback and St. Paul Mayor Coleman, Minnesota ranks 18th in the country on the number of mental health records submitted to the NIC system per 100,000 residents. For comparison, Arizona is ranked ahead of Minnesota at 15th, and Virginia is ranked first in the country. Yet NIC's background checks did not prevent two mass murderers from legally obtaining handguns used in the Gabrielle Giffords mall shooting in Tucson and the Virginia Tech school shooting. Remember, Arizona is ranked ahead of Minnesota, and Virginia is ranked number one in mental health record compliance, yet both sold handguns legally to mass murderers. Let me be clear. I am a lifetime NRA member, a federally licensed firearm dealer, and a law-abiding citizen gun owner. I want as much as anybody, perhaps more, to reduce and as much as possible eliminate gun crime. I support the NICS background check, as does the NRA, and want the gaps and inefficiencies in the current system addressed. What I can't support is putting additional burden on an existing flawed system at the expense of 10% of law-abiding citizens exercising their rights to bear arms for self-defense. Notice I said law-abiding citizens. It's critical in this argument. The overwhelming reason universal background checks will not be effective in reducing gun crime is quite simple and beyond argument, in my humble opinion. Criminals have not and will not subject to any kind of universal background check. They are criminals. They, by and large, obtain their firearms illegally. According to the ATF, 73% of guns used in crimes are obtained through straw purchases and theft. There was some testimony earlier that said theft represented a very small portion of this. It's 20%. The balance are straw purchases. It's not through private sales. Chronically recidivist criminals that have been put back on the streets commit the overwhelming majority of gun crimes. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, 70.2% of released prisoners with the highest rearrest rates are those that had already been imprisoned for possessing, using, or selling illegal weapons. These criminals do not, nor will they ever, go through a universal background check. I respectfully ask this body to pursue improving the integrity of our current background check system, aggressively enforce laws that prohibit the illegal transfer of firearm sales, such as straw purchases, and curb the continual re-release of reoffending criminals into our society. These are the keys to the effective reduction of gun crime. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vick, if I could ask you a couple of questions.
I'm just going to say we're trying to keep our... I'll ask you to be brief, because we don't want to take this out of the time, but I'm watching the clock very carefully.
So. Okay, I thought our questions were not taken out of the time.
Your questions will not be taken out of their time, but the goal is to have our questions in a time period after each side has had their presentation made. So if you have a brief...
Would you prefer I wait then?
I would prefer
you would,
unless it's just a brief clarification
of
something.
I'll wait, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you.
All right. Very welcome to the committee. Please state your name. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Rob Dorr. I am a DNR hunter safety instructor. I'm also a firearms instructor here in Minnesota, including advanced firearms training and permit to carry. A couple of unforeseen consequences that I've noticed in this bill, which I think need to be addressed. One of them is that we are any loans that are going over 12 hours, we are requiring go in through a federally licensed dealer. And that includes loans to hunting buddies. If I wanted to loan my cousin a sporting rifle for deer opener, we would have to go through a background check. And with the additional fees that this requires, we're talking about $100 for me to loan him a gun for a weekend. And he needs to first have a transferee permit. There's $25. We need to go through a federally licensed dealer who's going to charge us $25 to transfer it. At the end of the hunting expedition, I get my gun back. I need to have a transferee permit. There's $25. And then there's another $25 from the federally licensed dealer. And I think that is is borderline oppressive for anybody who would be loaning guns. I also, as a DNR hunter safety instructor, I loan out my firearms for my students to practice with. And if they don't have a firearm themselves, I would also need to, need to incur those expenses, or the student would. And we also, my business that I work for, we have corporate ownership of our handguns and some rifles. I don't personally own them. They belong to the business. So when I am conducting training, I am in possession of those firearms for weeks or months at a time. I would also, we would have that $100 that we were looking at for transferring. It would subsequently be $50 each time. But again, I think that's oppressive. And as was mentioned, I can no longer, if this bill goes into effect, I can't buy my gun, buy my wife a firearm without a transfer. So while that might save me a few $100 on her birthday, getting something cheaper, I think that would be an unintended consequence. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead with your testimony. And those of you, if you don't, make sure you sign in, too. I see the.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and guests. My name is Michael Undlin. Lived in the state of Minnesota for my whole life, out in Plymouth for 35 years, married for 35 years, beautiful wife, beautiful kids, well-educated. We like cats, dogs, horses, skiing, camping, etc. We're normal. I'm here to speak against this bill because of the way it takes away from Second Amendment rights of those who are non-violently, non-dangerously, non-criminally suffering from mental illness, or maybe having suffered from mental illness in the past. I am concerned for those who have sought hospital treatment for a medical condition and for those who now won't for fear of this law resulting in the loss of their constitutional rights without any due process of law, without any objective court adjudication. The law would bar anyone who ever received mental health treatment in a hospital, ever. 72-hour hold, mental illness as a primary diagnosis, and if I read the language right, according to the House research summary, would broaden the criteria for firearms disability to include voluntary confinement or hospitalization and any other means of entry to a treatment facility for any treatment of any mental illness in addition to court order. What that seems to me to mean that if you suffer mental illness as a secondary diagnosis while in the hospital for something else, such as a heart attack, breast removed surgery because of cancer, a stroke, whatever brought you into the hospital, sporting accident, whatever, if you fall into depression or you get anxious and you get treatment, all of a sudden you fall under this law. If you keep your gun, you're a criminal. One of the concerns I have with this is that this is all going to happen without any significant statistical difference between people suffering from mental illness and the general population with respect to the risk that they are of being or becoming violent. I am one of those people who under this law would have to give up my firearms or be made into a criminal at the gross misdemeanor level come August 1st, having not committed any crime of violence, no felonies, no crimes at all over the course of 57 years of life. I have never been, am not now, and won't become violent. I did and still do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder from a horrible event 7 years ago. I could tell you the date. I could tell you how many hours it went on. It was a horrible occurrence. I suffer from insomnia, rumination, anxiety, occasional depression, sometimes difficulty sustaining any efforts. I know how to take care of myself. I've had lots of therapy. I go to the gym. I exercise. I build up my endorphins that way instead of through medications. I go to the jacuzzi. I go to a movie. I talk to my wife. I make sure I sleep. It's very important.
I follow what I've learned. That's what the purpose of treatment is. In spite of all of that, if I keep my gun, I'm a criminal. The risk of violence for the vast majority of people who are being treated for mental illness is virtually the same as the general public. For the general public, according to some Harvard research, it's about 4.5 people out of 3.5 people out of 1,000. For people who suffer, in this example, not just being a member of the general public, but having bipolar disorder, that 3.5 out of 1,000 jumps all the way to 4.9 out of 1,000. So if you put 100 people in a room that are general public and 100 people in the room that have bipolar without substance abuse, you'll gain one person in terms of who might commit violence. You will destroy the rights, the pleasures, et cetera, of 95% of those people in favor of identifying or misidentifying five of them. So I find that very troubling. I'm going to just stop it right there because of the interest of time. One of my concerns is that the extent to which this hits people, if you include people who are simply ever in a hospital, is it becomes a Trojan horse relative to the number of people who are impacted, especially when you consider households because of constructive possession of a firearm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Undlin. There are 9 minutes left in this segment. Professor Olson, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Professor Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm here today as the president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I'm going to truncate my testimony to a great extent. The Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance doesn't have the money to hire or to fly in victims from other locations, but there are people who were connected with the Newtown situation who don't favor additional gun controls and who don't favor significant restrictions on law-abiding citizens. I have a document here that contains testimony, I believe, before the Connecticut legislature, and I'd like to ask that be distributed.
Thank you. We'll have it added to the public record, Professor.
Right. I have another document from Daryl Scott, whose daughter was killed at Columbine, and he says, "I'm not here to represent or defend the NRA because I don't believe they are responsible for my daughter's death." That is the millions and millions of law-abiding Minnesota gun owners, and gun owners in the rest of the world are simply not responsible for these problems, and beating up on us is not going to resolve them. Lastly, I have an article about a young man who was also at Columbine, who was one of the people who was being shot at. And he also believes that additional restrictions on law-abiding citizens will not work. I'm going to read to you one short one, though. This is from Cory Brooker. Cory Brooker is the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, probably the second or third city in America for murders. And he says, "To me, the data should drive our decision-making. So I know I'm not afraid of people having guns who are law-abiding citizens. In the analysis of gun murders and shootings in my city, I could find only one in the entire time I've been mayor. And unfortunately, there have been hundreds and hundreds where a person who was involved in a shooting, where they had their gun legally, where they legally acquired the gun. The guns that are causing carnage in our cities, including Minneapolis, my city, and our country, every year are illegally acquired. And in fact, it turns out that the one homicide in Newark that was conducted by a otherwise law-abiding citizen was a suicide. And we know from studies in other countries that gun laws do not eliminate suicides. They change the method, but they don't make it go away. Now, to get back to this bill, the significant part that I'm going to talk about is the requirement that every single firearm sale, except to certain relatives, which unfortunately doesn't include cousins and doesn't include spouses, but the transfer to every single firearm in Minnesota has to go through a federal firearms dealer. Now, that means there will be a NICS check. And yes, the NICS check does not have a record-keeping requirement. But it also means that every dealer will be booking that gun into his records, that there will be a form 4473 filled out on every single one of those firearms, and those 4473s stay at the dealer for a while, and when the dealer goes out of business, they go to ATF. They have a huge facility in West Virginia where they keep all these records. So yes, there is a registration system. It's a little bit indirect, and it's sort of klutzy at the moment. But all it would take is a few million dollars and some computer time to turn it into a complete and total registration system. And this makes that possible. At the moment, it's not. And Minnesota gun owners are absolutely adamantly opposed to registration, and that's what this bill does. It's a disguise, but it happens anyway. What Minnesotans might like is, I have to prove my identity to buy a firearm. Here's my identity. I have to prove that I've been through a background check. Here it is. I want to buy a gun from my associate here. Here they are. He's seen them. He knows that I'm a cleared person to sell firearms to. And all of the goals of this legislation are met without registration, without paperwork, and without cost.
Thank you, Professor. Sir, you have 3 minutes left.
Respectfully, Mr. Chairman, I think it's more like six or seven.
I've got 2:38 as my concluding time. I'll double-check on that while you testify.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Rothman. I'm the Vice President of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. You have to forgive me. I'm from New York, and I talk fast anyway. With the time limitations, I might talk a little faster. You know, we try to be patient. Professor Olson is incredibly patient. He's been coming here for 24 years and answering the same questions over and over. We try to be calm, to be logical, to present objective facts and evidence. But you know what? We're getting tired of it. I'm getting tired of it. Senator Champion is right. There is a problem in Minneapolis. Minneapolis has 7% of Minnesota's population and more than 40% of the homicides. Minneapolis outmurders the rest of the state by a factor of almost 800%. Oh, there's a problem in Minneapolis, a huge problem, but you know what? It has nothing to do with hardware. It also has nothing to do with me or with the 99.9% of law-abiding gun owners in Minnesota. We're not going to take your guns, we keep getting told. No, not all at once. Instead, these bills add obstacle after obstacle, impediment after impediment. Want to buy your buddy's gun? Add $50 to the price. Add $50 to exercise a constitutional right. That sounds a lot like me to a, like me. Sounds like a poll tax, a financial impediment to the exercise of a basic right. No background check is going to stop a criminal from getting his hands on a gun. I know that. 2.5 million Minnesota gun owners know it. And what's worse, I think the author knows it. We're not going to take your guns the way they say. Not all at once. Instead, the real intent, the real effect of these bills is to harass and tax and discourage the exercise of this constitutional right. That's what the District of Columbia attempted. That's what the City of Chicago tried to do. They both wrote multimillion dollar checks to the NRA and the Second Amendment Foundation for their legal fees, fighting those violations of constitutional rights. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you know what works. Treat the mentally ill, lock up the repeat offenders. That's going to be hard. It might even be expensive. But it's going to work. Harassing the law-abiding won't. You know, there's the story about the man who comes upon another man under a street light at night, and he's peering on the ground. And the first man says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm looking for my car keys." He looks at the street. He says, "Are you sure this is where you dropped them?" And he said, "No, I'm pretty sure I dropped them in the alley over there." "Well, why are you looking over here?" And the man looking says, "Well, because the light's better here." You're looking where the light's better, but you're not looking where the problem is. Look for where the solution really is, not where it's easy. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. I had this side starting at 2:03 and scheduled to end at 2:38. I did have a brief colloquy with Senator Cohn during that time, so I will add 1 minute. The time's until 2:39.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg Dahlstrom from Lakeville, Minnesota.
Thank you, sir. You have 2 minutes.
I'll make this very brief.
Unless there's anyone else who's going to want to testify as part of your side.
This bill does not have universal support. Gun controllers would have you believe that there is 80 to 90% approval on this bill. This is untrue. This number is based on a poll conducted by the Word Doctors on behalf of the Mayors Against Illegal Guns organization. The actual question posed was this: a proposal requiring all gun sellers at gun shows to conduct criminal background checks of the people buying guns. The reason this question had such high levels of support was because it's already existing law. All gun dealers must use NICS when selling a gun, even at a gun show. So what's the reality? From that same Word Doctors poll, 71% of non-NRA members and 83% of NRA members believe that gun laws should be less strict or kept the same. Additionally, an AG research poll conducted after the Sandy Hook shooting tragedy shows that of 1,000 participants, 93% oppose a national firearm registry and 92% oppose a ban on private sales of firearms. This bill is not a universal solution. The Justice Department agrees. In January, on President Obama's behalf, it released a memo stating that universal checks are insufficient without three things: registration of all firearms, continual checks of all firearm owners for eligibility, and confiscation of firearms. This ban will not reduce gun crime, but it will hinder the law-abiding citizen. Please do not support this bill. Thank you. I have copies of the polls, and
yeah, if you'd submit that for the record, we'll include it as part of the public record for the proceeding. Thank you, sir. You timed it perfectly. That concludes this portion of the hearing. We will now commence 10 minutes for public comment. So any members of the public that wish to make any additional comments, it's not restricted to one side or the other, but we'll give 10 minutes to this, and then we'll have 10 minutes for the committee to follow up with some discussion or questions, and then we'll conclude at 2:59. Sir, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Hello, my name is Rory Groves. Okay. This is the second time in 2 weeks I've been out to the Capitol. I actually have never been here before. But I felt that some of this legislation coming down, it deserved me to take time off of work. And I'm traveling from Northfield. Many people traveling from much further away. And I need to take the time off, and I need to come down, and I need to show my opposition to further gun restrictions. One of the things is I'm sitting here, and I'm listening to a lot of the testimony, and I just want to point this out. There's a lot of storytelling and anecdotal evidence about how some crime could have been prevented had certain measures been in place. And that's all well and good, and it seems to be par for the course for legislation. And this is new to me, as I said. I haven't observed this before. But I want you just to consider not the hard cases, right? As they say, hard cases make bad law. Consider the actual effect, not the good intentions, the actual effect of your legislation and what it will do. One of the things that our president says is if it can save just one life, we have to do it, or it's going to be worth it. I'd like to call out the example of Massachusetts. In the Boston Globe this week, they published an editorial which outlined the effect of gun registration, not gun control laws that were put into effect 10 years ago. At the same time, they were echoing the same sentiments in the legislature. The strictest gun control in the nation will save lives. This is what's going to happen. 10 years later, Massachusetts has double the homicide rate from gun violence that they did when they started out, when they put these laws in motion. Further, they have increased gun violence than they do in the surrounding states, including New York, Vermont, New Hampshire. The only difference is the number of law-abiding citizens has decreased from about 1.2 million to 200,000.
Sir, I'm going to give you 30 more seconds so we have others who wish to comment.
That's all I need. The point I'm making here is that increased gun control killed more lives than saved. They have hundreds of lives now on the books as being the effect of this legislation, which prohibited private citizens, law-abiding citizens, from arming themselves and protecting themselves. That is the record of gun control in other parts of this country, Chicago, D.C., L.A., New York City. Look at the statistics where gun control is the strictest. You will find the gun violence is the highest.
Thank you, sir. Ma'am, please identify yourself for the record. I'll give you 2.5 minutes as well.
My name is Mary Struford. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. And I am here today in support of the legislation for background checks. I support this because to do nothing to keep guns out of the hands of those who cannot handle the responsibility is to give up. It is saying that we are powerless to prevent gun violence. It is saying no to all the families who have lost loved ones due to gun violence, and it is not an option. I have heard it said today that this would create an inconvenience for those who want to sell a gun to a neighbor. If you are going to take into consideration the burden on the buyer and the seller, then you also must consider the burden or inconvenience of the victims and their families. When our daughter was kidnapped, raped, and murdered 2 weeks before her 19th birthday by two armed men, it was horrific. We went through months of inhibiting grief that reduced our capacities to do our jobs. The stress and the trauma dominated every aspect of our lives and those of our extended family, our friends, and our community. And we were just one family of the 30,000 gun violence victims that have similar experiences every year. None of these laws will stop all gun violence. It is a much bigger problem than that. But we need to start somewhere and do something, because to do nothing is not acceptable. If this change prevents only one death, and that person is your loved one, believe me, it will make a big difference to you. Minnesota gun violence victims deserve a vote on these bills. The families of Accent Signage deserve a vote. The young boy, Devin Ariel, shot while in his family minivan coming home from daycare, deserves a vote. And my daughter, Karen Struford, killed 21 years ago, deserves a vote on these bills. I urge you to remember the victims and their families when you consider these bills. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Doar, could you listen to her testimony instead of yucking it up with Mr. Rothman?
Senator Cohen, thank you.
I think with victims of these crimes, Senator Cohen, we can accord them the respect to listen to them.
Senator Cohen, thank you. Mr. Struford, we're sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
It's clearly still very raw for you. Sir, go ahead. You also have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gene Martin, and I pastor a church in Minneapolis called Joint Heirs with Christ, Faith International. And I pastor a congregation, and I have no less than 3 mothers who have lost their sons to senseless gun violence, and a father who lost his son to gun violence. November 13th, 2006, I was in the bed, had shortly dozed off to sleep that night, and I received a call from my son, and he told me that his mother had just been murdered. And I staggered out of the bed and went over there. And to this day, no one has been brought to justice on that horrific crime. I heard it said that, and it almost seems as though if you live in Minneapolis, your life is not very valuable. In fact, it was put pretty much in that state saying only 7% of the population of the state represents Minneapolis. But I'm here as a voice for Minneapolis. There's there's far more law-abiding citizens in our city, and many people are under stress of being shot, of being killed. And I'm here to represent those single mothers who are losing their sons to gun violence. And I've heard it said also this morning, this afternoon.
Sir, just to let you know, you have 30 seconds, sir.
Thank you. Contradictory statements. One saying because there's more guns on the streets now than ever before, and the violence is lower. Well, I just heard another testimony saying in Massachusetts and in New York there's more, the crimes are up. So what is it? You can't have it both ways. I'm here to represent this bill and to say we need a vote on this bill. We need to get as many guns off our streets as possible so that our people can live, so that our people can live in safety, so that people are not afraid walking around. And there's so many people that have legal access to guns and they're committing crimes also, just as in Oakdale. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Sir, so we fit in our time frame. You got 1 minute, please. So just identify your name, and then the other gentleman at the table will also have 1 minute, and we will end the this portion of the proceeding.
All right, Mr. Chair, committee members. I just wanted to point out that it has been 2 months, 1 week, and 5 hours and 10 minutes since the shooting at Sandy Hook. Nothing has been done.
Sir, please state your name for the record.
Curtis Anderson. Sorry, I thought I got that. Nothing has been done. We're talking about business as usual constantly. This is business as usual. This is exactly what we do. There's no armed guards in our schools. There's no immediate action being taken or has been taken to fix the situation that's happened. If everyone's so terrified about their children, and I have seven nieces and nephews, I don't have a child of my own, but I fear for them when they, you know, in situations where they could be harmed, absolutely. And I would feel great if there was an armed guard at their school. This is not solving anything. And as you said, Mr. Chair, during your speech about the gay marriage amendment, you said this is going to stick, this is going to take, and it's going to be hard to overturn it. This is the same thing for us. Just take time and think about it. It's something that needs more time. It's been
Thank
2 months.
Sir. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off only because we have one
That's
more
right.
person
Thank you.
To get some
Appreciate
testimony.
The time.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. 1 minute, sir.
My name is Arthur Bork. I'm from Cambridge, Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members, right now I'm more thinking about answering a previous person. I didn't catch her name, but she mentioned her daughter being killed by two armed men who decided to rape and basically terrorize and then kill her. Well, it wasn't the guns that did the raping. It wasn't the guns that decided to kill her. It was the two men who decided to kill her. It's the same as a person who decides to go to a bar, get drunk, and drive, and kill someone because they're drunk and driving. We don't blame the car for the person doing the drinking. We don't blame the alcohol for the person deciding to drink it. So why are we trying to blame the gun for someone deciding to use it? That's pretty much it right now.
All right. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. And be sure to sign in before you leave. So that will conclude the public comment portion of this. Now we have 10 minutes for the committee to discuss or to ask questions of any of the testifiers who are still here.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin, I had heard your voice earlier, so go ahead and then we'll go to Senator Goodwin.
Okay, mine's just real quick. I heard people come up and talk about the mental health issue here, and particularly the gentleman over there, and I certainly do understand that. I had the same issues with that part of the legislation because I'm concerned that people won't go to get mental health help, and that may cause more problems with gun violence, not because people with mental health issues are violent, but people that are violent won't go to get mental health help, and people that are dual diagnosed with both chemical dependency and mental health won't. But I spoke with Senator Champion yesterday and talked about my concerns, and he did say at the beginning of this meeting that he was working with the mental health associations, and he was going to definitely take care of that language. So we should be seeing, at least in that part of it, we should be seeing some changes so that people aren't discouraged from going in and getting mental health help.
Thank you, Chairman. Senator Goodwin.
I did hear that. Sir, please state your name for this. Mr. Undlin, was
Michael, it? Michael Undlin, yes.
Yes, sir.
My concern was that the way the bill was written, even though there was some loose discussion about some possible changes, I don't know what they are. So I addressed the bill as it is. Thank you.
And just so there's clarity, at the point when we bring back an omnibus proposal for the committee to consider, there will be, again, a public hearing, and we'll have an opportunity to take a look at the specific language there and comment on it as well. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I wanted to compliment you for running a very timely and well-organized hearing today. These are always difficult. And yet, at the same time, I keep hearing from certain members of the audience that they deserve a vote. Is there an intention to vote on the bill? That's what I thought we were here for. Eventually, we'll be voting on this bill. Is that correct?
Senator Limmer, eventually, the chairman, I will present a proposal for an omnibus bill utilizing one of the Senate files as a vehicle, and it will include the components that I think ought to move forward, and the committee will then have an opportunity to agree or disagree or to add or subtract as we see fit under the normal process.
Mr. Chair, the only reason I am mentioning that, it seems like it's a theme development going on that people are seeking a vote, and we will be voting.
That's correct, Senator.
And so just to make sure it's not like other parts of the country that same accusation has been made and sought, and just to rest assured, I'm anxious to vote on this just as much as anyone else. These are tough issues, and we got to sort through them.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if you wouldn't mind if I could ask Mr. Vick to answer a couple of questions, if that'd be
Mr.
okay.
Mr.
Vick, from your testimony, my inference is that you're a highly responsible, reliable individual, somebody who takes those responsibilities quite seriously and has given some thought to them. Here's my concern, though, because I accept your testimony when you described some of the percentages and talked about, I'm going to misstate this, but, 10% and so on. But we had the testimony of Mayor Ryback relative to Susan Berkowitz and the person she murdered. I happen to know Susan Berkowitz, didn't know her. She was a constituent of mine. And, in fact, knew the parents of the woman who was murdered. In fact, the woman's mother is a former ambassador to the Netherlands. And Susan Berkowitz was able to get a gun apparently through some private sale. Relative to the testimony of, I'm not sure of her name, but Ms. Seifert, if that's
Streifert.
The correct... Pardon?
Streifert,
I'm sorry. There's been a theme of inconvenience, of, I think, a fear of registration, which I don't quite understand. If we can save a handful of lives by the passage of a strong, and I accept the testimony about there are weaknesses in the system that have to be corrected and things that ought to be done to make sure the system is strengthened. But assuming that's all done, is the inconvenience to thousands of gun owners who are responsible, reliable, like yourself, is that inconvenience something that is paramount and more important than saving what might be viewed as a very small number of lives.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Cohen, let me respond to that in that I made no reference in my testimony to inconvenience whatsoever.
I understand that.
And so that question is probably better directed to someone other than myself. But to answer your question, this isn't a matter of inconvenience. We're inconvenienced in a number of ways for a number of good reasons that help protect citizens. This is a matter of right, and most importantly, the Second Amendment right that we all have. So it's not a matter of being inconvenienced in this, and when you say saving a handful of lives, I value human life as much as anyone. There are much more effective ways to save human lives than to foist feel-good, knee-jerk, politically expedient bills to make the public think that something's being done for the common good, for the safety of everyone. And this doesn't do that. This doesn't do that. What this does is put restrictions on 10% of the population of law-abiding citizens in their right to bear arms. Attached to that, what you're not doing is you're not addressing. Now, I've heard some things in some other bills that were very heartening to me. I'm very, very much behind making sure that we act on recidivism, that we act on gun crimes, the current legislation that we have, that we need to enforce, that we don't enforce. Those things need to be taken very seriously. There are laws in effect to do that. So if you want to save lives, please focus on the important issues in addressing that issue, not costing the rights of 10%
well,
of
thank you. Just so the committee knows, we have 2 minutes left, and Senator Ortman has a question. I'd like to ask Professor Olson a question as well. So go ahead, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me try to do this quickly then. Maybe we could just go a couple minutes over so we could have the questions for Senator Ortman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vick, is it your testimony then that passage of this law would under no circumstance save a single additional life with a single background check?
Mr. Chair.
This will never work with anybody, anywhere, anytime.
Mr. Vick. Mr. Chair, Mr. Cohen, I've answered the question. The question was, do we want to infringe on the rights of 10% of law-abiding citizens? And my answer is no.
Well,
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of very brief comments. I appreciated everyone that came to the Capitol today, whether they're in this room or not, sharing their thoughts and views. These are very sensitive issues from all sides. And so I appreciate the thoughtful testimony. I am two points. Senator Champion, I am not in favor of the imposition on the mentally ill in this bill. And I hope that you will take those changes out on pages 2 and 4, I think it is. I hope that you'll take them out. Because if you have someone who's adjudicated mentally ill, that person has had due process. They've been through a hearing. They've had a right to have a doctor testify. They've had a right to a lawyer. And I think that's a really important standard here. And when you get beyond that, even though I heard what the chiefs had to say here and I'm concerned about them, you're talking about people who have not had a chance to be heard in opposition. And one of the important balances in the concealed carry law that we have in Minnesota is that shall issue portion of the bill that says that there isn't going to be discretion, that the chiefs and the sheriffs won't be making a decision on a case-by-case basis. We can all count on the fact that there will be a shall issue. If you qualify, you're entitled, because it's a right to have that permit. And so I hope that you will consider that when you bring the bill back for further consideration. And Mr. Chair, to you, I appreciate all the hearings that you're having, but I'm very concerned about your plan to bring an omnibus bill. I would hope and I request that you would consider having us vote on these bills individually instead of in an omnibus package, because I think that you probably could build very widespread support for some of these bills. But when you start adding in more and more, it's going to get more and more complicated, more divisive, more polarizing, and it will create an awful lot of conflict that we don't need to have. We may find some provisions that we can all agree on, and I hope you'll try. That would be my request.
Thank you. Senator Champion, did you want to respond briefly? Then I'll ask Professor Olson if he come up to the table for just a moment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank
Senator
you.
Senator Champion.
Senator, yes, we will take those comments into consideration. As I mentioned earlier, we are working with NAMI and the other mental health folks in order to make sure that we are sensitive to mental health issues and how we want to make sure that they're getting the services that they need without us, you know, demonizing them or stigmatizing them in a way that this bill is not intended to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Professor Olson, I just had a question for you. You had used an example. You held up your driver's license and you held up another card
yes.
to indicate that you apparently have received some sort of clearance and are thereby authorized.
I have a carry permit.
Okay.
The carry permit law requires that there be a background check annually.
Okay. So would you support proposal that would require everyone who wishes to purchase a gun first acquire a carry permit or go through a comparable screening process?
I've learned over the years to never commit without seeing the actual language, but that sounds interesting.
That sounds noncommittal, Professor.
Not exactly.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
This conversation will continue this evening. We will take public testimony, which will be restricted only in the sense of we'll keep everyone down to about 2.5 minutes each so that we can have time to hear from everyone that we can. We will not be we will be handing out tickets. I think, in fact, they're already distributed for this evening they're in the process of being distributed. I'm seeing right now for this evening. We will be back in this room. We will reconvene at 6 p.m. Senate File 458 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and we are now in recess. Thank you.